Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one, who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Okay, Moors, listen up. Starting this Wednesday coming, Tahaga presents the online conference call. The call-in number to dial is 712-432-3100. The access code, 865-074. That's 712-432-3100. Access code 865074. Make sure you're there. Lined up 7:45 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's Wednesday night at 7:45 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We're going to deal with internet marketing. We're going to be able to converse with one another, and so that we can get a lot of work done here in the United States. We're going to be dealing with your mortgage problems, your student loans, whatever it is. Dial into our Wednesday night conference call starting at 7:45 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The call-in number once again is 712-432-3100. Access code 865074. See you Wednesday night. I've been asked over and over by a lot of people about the exercising your freedom of rights to travel. And that is something that I have done. I've done it quite well, and I do it today. However, it is something that you have to understand. First of all, there are things that you need to know in order to have the confidence to get out there on that pavement and defend yourself and be able to do this thing successfully. This information is contained in Tucker's archives. Go to www.newfreehelpgroup.com, and once you look over that page, click on TuckerArchives.org. Go over there, and you'll see Tucker's Archives Master Library, where the audio, video, the documentation, and everything else that you would need is right there available for you in order for you to exercise your freedom of rights to travel. That saves you a ton of money. That saves you jail. That keeps you from having to have a driver's license, tag, registration, and all that kind of stuff. www.newfreehelpgroup.com. Once you get there, contact me, Tahaka Amana L. Bay, at area code 904-303-9061. Try to call me before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Welcome, Moors and Moors Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay. And this evening, we have a very, very informative program for you. I was listening to this gentleman. I've listened to him before, and he has shared quite a bit of light on some stuff that I've been researching back. I've been trying to get in information on the Bairu, the Anunnaki, and the creation of man and all of that stuff. We're going to answer the question this evening, what is Nibiru? Who are the Anunnaki? What is the ancient hidden information? What does the Bible have to say about this? Who really created man and woman on earth? How can this information be verified? What about the Emerald Tablets? Who came out of Mesopotamia? What came out of Mesopotamia and Egypt? And who was Enki and Thoth? We're going to deal with this here this evening. And the reason why I'm bringing this information out is because in my own research, I found some gaps missing. And I was able to do the research on what I heard from this interview, from this interview between these two guys. And what I want to do, we got four segments to present here this evening, and these segments are about 38 minutes apart. And I want you to listen very, very carefully. And if, for those of you who do Bible research along with the other research that you do, you might want to check out the various scriptures mentioned in this broadcast and cross-reference that with what you got and do some verification on this thing. If you are listening to this broadcast for the first time, we offer free articles here in order to get Secrets of America, the Commerce Game, and How to Play, the Truth About the 14th Amendment, and the U.S. Bankruptcy and the more. Send me an email to tahaka53@hotmail.com, and I'll send that to you. You just have to, all you got to do is say, Tahaka, send me those free articles you mentioned on your show last night. That's it. And I'll put it, get it right straight out to you with the quickness, okay? Keep in mind that every Wednesday night at 7:45 p.m., we're going to be hosting our National Financial Conference Call. And that is where we give you information about various techniques that you can use to make money right there in the privacy of your home on your own computer. There's a ton of businesses out there, but a lot of people have jumped on a whole lot of stuff, and I've been getting a lot of calls from people to say, well, I've tried this and I've tried that, and I have yet to be able to do it. But there is a way to do this where you can actually make money, and I have learned from some experts. As a matter of fact, I invested in internet marketing, marketing education, period. And what we're going to do, we're going to be able to give you what we have on a free national conference call. You can bring your pills and paper to the conference call and make sure you write down what you are getting as we tell you exactly what to do, how to go about doing it, how to build your own websites, what's good, what's not good, how to generate the capital that you need in this type of business venture. The call-in number for the conference call, once again, is 712-432-3100, and the access code is 865-074. Okay? Now, what I'm going to do is after the first segment, we're going to break for a commercial, and if you have questions and comments in between these segments, raise your hand, I'll open it up, we can deal with your question and comments, okay? But without further ado, we are going to go directly into Nibiru and Anunnaki and the creation of man. So if you all will hold your hat and listen very, very carefully. This train will move out the station kind of slow starting up, but then as we get down into the midways of the first part of this, we get to getting into the meat and potatoes of this thing, and then you can begin to do your cross-references on and research on this stuff, okay? All right.
Out of the dark of the deep range and into the light of the deep strange, come at the hour, come at the mothership that is Coast to Coast AM. And how are you this evening? It's good to be with you. John B. Wells in the left seat for the evening. And tonight on the program, Gerald Clark. He was on the program with Mr. Norrie back a couple of months ago. However, there's so much to talk about, 8 hours wouldn't get it. but he'll be with us for the program tonight. And we will discuss many things, mostly the Anunnaki of Nibiru. I'm probably saying it wrong, but I can't help it. Hope you had a good week. And we are now in certain parts of the country and world into the first day of the week. Somebody sent an email last weekend and said, why do you insist on calling Sunday the first day of the week? Because it is. Monday is the first day of the work week for the proletariat, you see. And so, my comrades, my people, let's just touch on a couple of things. This video, when it went to YouTube, wound up being one of the most disliked ever. If it's not the most disliked, thumbs down thing in the history of YouTube, it'll certainly do until the most disliked video is posted on YouTube, and that is the NSA's Director General Keith Alexander actually demanded Thursday, I'm taking this from Glenn Greenwald, the London Guardian, he demanded Thursday that the reporting being done by newspapers around the world on this secret surveillance system be halted. Yes, the head of the embattled National Security Agency, General Keith Alexander, is accusing journalists of selling his agency's document and is calling for an end to the steady stream of public disclosures of secrets snatched by former contractor Edward Snowden. Quote, I think it's wrong that the newspaper reporters have all these documents, the 50,000 whatever they have, and are selling them and giving them out as if these, you know, it just doesn't make sense. Neither did your sentence, sir. He said it in an interview with the Defense Department's Armed with Science blog. Continuing the quote, we ought to come up with a way of stopping it. I don't know how to do that. That's more the courts and the policymakers. But from my perspective, it's wrong to allow this to go on. Well, there's this old movie called Deadline with Humphrey Bogart. And, the editor uses the final issues of his paper to crusade against this gangster. And so the guy's going, what is that? Bogart's got him on the phone. What is that? What's going on? What's up? And Bogart replies, that's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing. And so, there it is, sir. It's the press. And at least so far, there's nothing you can do about it. Anyway, tonight when we get Gerald Clark on the line, we're going to talk about some very, very strange stuff. You know, privacy, as we have known it, is pretty much floated on downstream, unless, of course, we can get it back through the courts. DARPA is developing an implant that can read brain signals in real time. I'm telling you, this is going to be a fantastic interview. Gerald Clark is a 1994 graduate of University of California at San Diego. He holds an MSCE in Electronic Circuits and Systems and a Bachelor's of Science in Computer Engineering. He's the author of several papers in the communications and electronics field, well known for his work in the San Diego high technology industry, awarded several patents in the free space optical laser communications field, and during the years 96 through 02, working as a telecommunications executive, his business travels took him to various parts of the world, exposing him to a plethora of cultures, which acted as a catalyst for his research into mankind's earliest technologies and accomplishments, including the cultures of, yes, Mesopotamia and the surrounding areas of Turkey, Egypt, Persia, and Iraq, eventually leading to the, see if I can pronounce this correctly, cuneiform inscribed tablets left by the Sumerians. And who are these Anunnakis anyway? And what's up? And what is his connection with Zachariah Sitchins. Almost said Stitchins. Actually, I did say it. Forget it. Anyway, this is going to be a good one. UFO sightings, the Bible, all kinds of things. So get ready. You're going to need a proper mug of tea for this one tonight, because this should really be quite an eye-opener. Here's the thing. You know, I keep making this reference to the awakening of 2012. We were getting ready for the awakening. Well, behold,
The awakening has been well underway all the way through 2013 and shows no signs of slowing down. And even the NSA directors are saying, well, you've just got to stop this. It's like, it's taken on a life of its own now. It's not going to stop. Behold, here comes some more on the Saturday night edition of Coast to Coast AM. Hang on tight and stand by. His book, The Anunnaki of Nibiru, Mankind's Forgotten Creators, Enslavers, Saviors, and Hidden Architects of the New World Order. Without further ado, let's welcome onto the bridge in the mothership, Gerald Clark. Welcome, sir.
Hey, John. It's really nice to be here tonight, and welcome to all your listeners.
You know, you've been around quite a bit. What a remarkable career. So, you know, for those who missed the program the last time that you were on and are unfamiliar with your work, because there is you have no website. This is unusual. Are you trying to withdraw from the system, or what's up?
I have Luddite tendencies, but I actually have commissioned to get my website done. It'll be GeraldClark77.com as soon as it's up.
Okay. Okay. All right. Very good. Gerald Clark 77, yeah?
Yes.
And it's coming. Okay.
Yep.
Well, tell us all about you and how you started and decided, well, I think I'll go to the University of California in San Diego and get into electronics. I mean, were you just inclined that way? Did you build Heathkit radios when you were a kid? Or just how did you become the man that you are and then go on to do the rather adventurous work that you have taken on?
Well, I'm not sure how far I'm allowed to go back. I guess we have
go back
time,
as far as you like. We've got the whole show.
Well, I was born in California, and by the time I was three, my folks moved us back to the Midwest, and specifically we ended up in the northwest corner of Arkansas. And my stepfather had roots in Oklahoma, so it kind of made sense for him. But my mother and father were both working in the aircraft assembly business up in the Long Beach area when they met.
Gotcha.
So I was born in California and got transplanted when I was seven. To the northwest corner of Arkansas, where we lived on a very remote farm.
Yeah, there's some culture shock for you.
Well, it was interesting. I was actually kind of embarrassed. I had this California stigma about me. I'm like, you know, I'm better than you kind of thing. So I didn't associate with people like I probably should have. And I'll get back to that. But anyway, in the ninth grade, I got involved in science. And I think I had a natural science bent anyway. I was constantly taking things apart, trying to figure things out. And so I built a small solar tracker, having seen a similar design in popular mechanics. And the attractive part about it was it used a simple little servo, a dual-acting servo that had an expandable gas either side of it that was propane. I welded some propane tanks. And then it had a little arm that would turn it toward the sun with some blinders. Pretty simple. And it worked, and I won second place for it in the state science fair contest.
Cool.
And my science fair teacher was quite thrilled. Anyway, I got exposed to the Secretary of Energy at that time and started thinking about researching this area. So it stuck with me, and it was an idea I wanted to expand my research sometime in the future, even though it wasn't really clear to me how I was going to do that. But I had the certificate in my hand, and it was my ticket out of kind of a very poor situation we were living in. And
So
academia seemed to me like the way out of a potential life of poverty. And a lot of farmers in that area were very poor.
Gotcha. Yeah.
So from there, my real father still lived in San Diego, so I had aspirations to go to college. I was the first one in my family to do it. So I went back to California when I was 17, so I was on a farm living like a farm boy from 7 to 17, and I absolutely loved it. It made me the person I am today.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so I went back to UCSD in San Diego, where I thought I was going to establish residency and finish up my last year of high school and go to college. That was my plan. And so while I was there, I got exposed to a guy who was heavy into flying, and it was my childhood dream to fly. And he owned a P-51 Mustang that he was restoring out of Montgomery Field here in San Diego. And here I was, a 17-year-old with dreams of flying, and this guy was letting me close to it on frequent occasions. And so it kind of fanned the flames for me to want to live my dream. Well, while I was in college at UCSD in electrical engineering, I'd just gotten in there, and everything was set. I got a call from somebody in the aviation business who wanted to know if I wanted to take a flight slot, because I'd taken a test under the guidance of this guy who had the P-51 Mustang. His name was Bill Spears, by the way. He's kind of a well-known guy.
Yeah.
He ended up dying in that P-51 when one of the oil valves went out and smeared oil on his windshield. He crashed the thing. So anyway, So I went off and decided I was going to do my childhood dream, and I spent 7 years in the Army flying helicopters.
Wow.
So that was an absolute dream come true for me. I wasn't so much about the institution as I was about flying, but I still served my country honorably for 7 years, and I really have a deep honor and bond with all those who are still serving.
Understood. Hey, listen, before we stray too far from the Mustang, was it the D model or the H model?
It was the D model.
Oh, there's not much rudder on that thing.
Yeah. I never got to fly it. He was still restoring it. The part I got exposed to, he was taking parts and having them heat tempered and shuttling them back and forth up to some factory in L.A. where they were doing this work for him. And so it was a neat experience, though, to be exposed to something like that.
Yeah, I'll bet. I've always wanted one of those, but they're about $1 million now, so forget about it.
No. Yeah. So I had aspirations of being an electrical engineer in UCSD, and I put that on hold for 7 years and got about 1,500 flight hours getting flown all over the place. I did 5 rotations at the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, California, where I got exposed to some really neat high-tech equipment that was being used for battle simulations, including the MILES integrated laser system. So that was kind of neat. And had a neat encounter there while we were at what they called the Star Wars building on top of the Bicycle Lake Army Airfield, where they used to do the debriefings. We were there one day after a battle sequence, a simulated sequence against the motorized rifle regiment of the Soviets. That's how they were training way back then. And this was about circa 1985, by the way. So Tom Clancy showed up there, and he was doing research for one of his books, and it really inspired me. So I read all Tom Clancy's books while I was in the military there.
Excellent.
Yeah. So once I got out of the military, I came back to San Diego, having served in Korea and spent a lot of time in Germany and 4 years in Fort Raleigh, Kansas, in the first attack helicopter battalion and the quarter cav. I was an air cavalry member at the last year of my service there. So anyway, I left there in 1989, came back to San Diego, determined to finish up my engineering degree. And that's exactly what I did. So I went right back to UCSD, right back to Royal Bell College, and finished up my engineering degree.
So what kind of helicopters were you flying? Comanches or?
Well, we had at Fort Riley the AH-1S Cobras, and then we had the modernized Cobras across the airfield, which the cavalry had. And the first attack helicopter battalion, when I left there in 1990, was just getting brand new Apaches from Mesa, Arizona. These were my last orders, to go pick up an Apache in Mesa, Arizona, go for unit training at Fort Hood, Texas, and then Fort Rucker Flight School or Flight Training School, where I was going to be an instructor pilot, and then off to Germany for 3 years. And I gave that up to go back and study engineering. But I really loved flying, and I really loved the brotherhood of the aviators.
Oh, yeah, it gets in your blood, and it stays there, doesn't it?
It's never left. As a matter of fact, I'm kind of a hard critter to deal with. We swore oaths when we were in flight school not to lie, cheat, or steal, or tolerate anybody that does. And we try living like that in this order of reality and see what happens. There's a lot of bird that flies, yeah. Mm-hmm. So from there, I got back to San Diego, and I got involved in a very interesting startup company. This might tie us into this DARPA question that you had about the 3D printing. Yeah. And then I got involved in what's called the Rotorcraft Pilot Associate Program, where they wanted to capture everything I knew about taking an aircraft in complex simulation environments and essentially picking my brain, capturing it in rules, and then encoding this in an unmanned autonomous vehicle like a drone in order to have it do what you do. Right. So this was integrated. And back in 1989, I did this, and we encoded into an artificial intelligence language called CLIPS, which was C language integrated production systems. And it's used by a lot of the neurology and, I don't know, the different computer science and neurology specialists that they have in the education programs now. So they're into this data mining idea heavily.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so
on every level, it seems.
Yes, at every level. So from there, I ended up getting in, and I learned a whole lot about evolutionary algorithms and all the crazy things that model the brain, model how, what's interesting in environments, sensor fusion, and all those kind of things. And we did a lot of work. I did this for 7 years. So it was a company called Reticular Systems, and it was based on, believe it or not, the brain mechanism, the reticular activating system that caused awareness and attention. And we were very focused on that in this sensor fusion arena. So, have you heard of that?
Mm, Not really. I'm not going to tell you that I have. Maybe just a little blip in a Jane's Defense publication of some sort, but not really.
Right. Well, this was a DARPA program, and anytime DARPA is involved, and I'm sure they're listening. Anytime DARPA is involved, it's for defense purposes, and they can tell you it's about, you know, maybe for your health, or they're trying to help Parkinson's, or whatever it is they put out the cover story. But ultimately, if it's developed for DARPA, it's developed for the Department of Defense.
Sure.
So, you know, the kind of technology they end up with is not something I ended up being real supportive of. So later on, I ended up working at Tuning Communications, where I was doing, actually before that, I was at Loral Telemetry and Instrumentation, where I was doing satellite programs. And that was really interesting, learning about how data is put on and off carriers and so on and so forth. It made me merely start thinking about how data could be put on and off a carrier relative to humans later in my life. So I've watched that space very closely as well.
You know, I've heard a report recently about someone near and dear to me just said, listen, I heard it. I could tell by the sound where it was coming from. And when the light shifted just slightly, it gave itself away. This thing was cloaked. I mean, you know, anything that we hear about is normally 30 years behind what's actually out there. Are they getting close to being able to cloak these craft, or is there anything to suggest they've already done it?
Well, I was looking at an article on 3D printing where this guy from, where is he from? He's at Duke University, and his name
is Yaroslav.
Can you pronounce his name? Yeah, well, he's working on an invisibility cloak, and I've been seeing this going on for a while. So what do we know about visible and invisible and microwave energy in terms of its cloaking its effect on a reflective object? And that's really what it comes down to, is what do we know? Can we do it? Well, we see in the B-2 stealth bombers that if you adjust the angles of the reflective material such that the energy doesn't go back to the emanating source, that you don't get a reflection. Or if you do get one, it's so small it looks like a bird. And that's what, you know, that's essentially what's going on with the B-2 stealth program. Those kinds. So it's a passive type of cloaking, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I've heard about this stuff called, somebody was calling it smart skin. Oh, there you go. There you go. Beautiful. Well, is there anything to suggest that we're still online? Sky Chief Brian, are we online? How about that? I'm telling you. I'll tell you a quick story. Right down here at the undisclosable location, someone near and dear to me, who's absolutely, his credentials are beyond reproach, showed me a little movie that he had taken on his little iPhone 4. And what it looked like to me was people will say, it was just spotlights. No, we know what they look like. This will be posted eventually on Caravan to Midnight. A half dozen little light orbs all gathered together in a little line. You know, sometimes they'll just kind of, here we are. And then they proceeded to follow each other into a very dim light that looked like moonlight behind a cloud. But it wasn't. It was a full moon that night, but this was not the moon. One after another, these six just added to this dim little moon behind the cloud's light, and it became brighter and brighter and brighter. And then three or four or five, six other ones joined it. And it looked like the boys, and maybe the girls too, just all joining back up to the mothership. Strange. Well, apparently, maybe DARPA pulled the plug. Maybe they'll plug it back in. We'll do our best to get back online with Gerald Clark in just a moment. This is Coast to Coast AM. Yes, a right brutal bunch of buggers they have been. And will be again, I predict. Ask anyone who's been probed. Right. I don't really understand why it is. Yes, actually, I do. But you know what?
just to put a weed up that kilt. I'm going to read you some more. DutchNews.nl, America's NSA tapped 1.8 million Dutch phone numbers in 1 month. The American National Security Agency tapped 1.1 million Dutch telephones in 1 month alone as part of its boundless informant surveillance program with two M's and an E, Dutch media reported on Monday. The raw information was first published by Der Spiegel, in June, but has now been interpreted by Dutch technology website Tweakers, following publication in Le Monde. That's the world. Between the beginning of December and beginning of January, 1.8 million Dutch phone numbers were tapped into by the NSA, recording information about number and possibly location, Tweakers said. This comes from one of my very favorite websites, Full Spectrum Dominance, with dashes between the words, .com. The numbers were compared against a database of suspect numbers, and Tweaker says if a number was on the list, calls to and from the number were listened to. In Germany, 500 million numbers were picked up. In France, 70 million. Paris has now summoned the U.S. ambassador to explain events. According to Le Monde, documents show the NSA was allegedly targeting not only terrorist suspects, but politicians, business people, and others. The raw information comes from whistleblower Fast Eddie Snowden. There's a quote here by Klaus Dijkhoff, a VVD parliamentarian. Quote, who was the Chinese, the Russians, then no one would be surprised. But this is an ally, and that makes it extra disappointing. Indeed. Well, we've got the screens up now. We've called on occupants of interplanetary craft to perhaps put a field around the mothership so we might maintain our communications link with our guest tonight, Gerald Clark. Isn't it funny? Just as you get to a salient point, I thought the man had been vaporized. We shall see when we return on Coast to Coast AM. Gerald, are you there?
I'm here.
Are you okay?
I never heard such a sound in my phone before, I have to say.
Yeah, you should have heard it through headphones. Oof.
Really?
Yeah, I thought you'd been vaporized, and maybe me too.
I may have lost a few brain cells, but I'm ready to go.
Where the heck were we?
I think I was about to switch over from passive invisibility cloaks to something a little more active that this researcher is working on.
Is that smart skin thing?
Mm-hmm.
Ah.
So it's quite interesting what they're doing, and they've only picked the 9.7 to 10.1 gigahertz where they're running this thing through a microscopic modulator, which is a small conductive cylinder that takes in these wavelengths and then sends them out the cloak side of the object that they're trying to get the radar signature on, and it disperses the energy orthogonal and up into the atmosphere on the cloak side so it doesn't shoot back to the transmitting side. So they're doing this in the gigahertz range, and I guess the concern is, well, what about if you do it in visible light range, 400 to 700 nanometers? And these guys say at the bottom of the article they can do it.
No kidding.
Yep.
Well, if we're just hearing about it now, it seems like they've probably been able to do it for a while, but that's probably me just being cynical again.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. Well, they've been using different decoys and things on the battlefield for eons, you know, whether it was a simulated tank that you blew up or whether it was a camouflage technique. But decoys are very, very big in military tactics. So I think this would be a significant military advantage to anybody who had this technology.
Boy, I'll say. You know, it begs the question. There have been lots of allegations, declarations without proof for anyone who is unclear on the meaning of that word. I had to look it up. People are beginning to suspect that this technology doesn't just materialize from nowhere. By way of just I'll make a microscopic processor. You know, meaning something so small we have to view it through a microscope, I presume, and little bots and things like that. I mean, people are beginning to suspect that we're not only working with alien technology, but probably the aliens themselves. Where does this stuff come from? Where do these extraordinary ideas come from? I mean, I know these people are working on it, got nothing to do all day except work on it, but, man, we sure have made some quantum leaps, would be putting it mildly,
in the technology that's out there and being refined and developed.
Yeah, I don't think it would take too much of a stretch of imagination to consider if we did have an encounter with an alien species that was far more advanced than we were, that given our state of consciousness and how we live in duality, the us and them, that I think we would try to get military technology out of them in order to foster our position on the planet in a greedy, selfish kind of way. I think we would do that based on where we are. So
well, you know,
would they trade a military base that's guarded by our people for advanced technologies to include advanced military drives, communication protocols, include CDMA and things like that? For sure they did, and I truly believe that.
Yeah, after a while, you know, there's enough evidence. You can't deny it after a point. And in fact, after the part about not only working with alien technology but the aliens themselves comes the, well, say, the world is running in such a zany way with the so-called adults who are, in fact, our leaders. I wonder if a lot of this stuff is being orchestrated from off-planet.
Well, a lot of that I covered in the very last chapter of my book, but based on the genealogy table that I came up with, starting with some research from Sitchin and Lawrence Gardner, and some of the declarations by the entities, the Anunnaki that were here themselves, that they stayed, it's pretty clear from their symbols and the governments that they've affiliated with that some of them did stay. And based on their behavior in the past, we're seeing the same thing now. It's practically like the Hatfields and McCoys, and it makes you wonder if these are our progenitors. Is there any hope for us? And I've had many readers ask me that.
Well, you know, we've got so much to talk about tonight. I'm going to jump around all over the place, and I will leave it up to you to kind of make it a little bit more linear, because I'm not a linear guy, really.
Well, I'm not either, so we might be in trouble.
Okay, cool. Well, let's go over to this thing about the implant that can read brain signals in real time that DARPA's working on.
Right. Well, let's back up a little bit and talk about brainwave signals, first of all. We know that they operate from about 0 to 20 hertz, and then they got segregated into various regions. We call it delta, theta, alpha, and beta. And each one of those regions has certain attributes that humans have, like in the alpha stage, or actually in the beta stage, we're supposedly in our waking consciousness. So that's around anywhere from 10 to 13, 20 hertz, somewhere in there. If you're around 13 hertz, you're probably ADD.
Right.
So we know, it's a very limited range for brainwave, and we can measure this on an EEG. So what do we know about sensor fusion? We know that if you can bring all these things together, these disparate sensors, whether it's a CCD camera or something with a proximity sensor, whatever, and it's analogous to a human. We use our eyes and our ears and our touch and our taste and our sight or our feel, and we bring this all together, and it produces a thought in our brain where it's interpreted. And we can see this on an EEG. So it seems to me that what DARPA is up to is, do we have the technology to read a brainwave in real time and decode it? Probably yes. I mean, I'd say we've probably been able to do that for 50 years. Easy.
So we're looking at, right, that one sticks in a snap, interdiction, and they just take the person that just had the random brain flat away at that point? I mean, is that where we go? Is this like the ultimate pre-crime tool?
Well, with things like the electromagnetic spectrum, if you can transmit a signal that falls into the 0 to 20 hertz brainwave region and that signal has a higher amplitude than the one that you're generating internally, then you're going to get jammed, essentially. So that in and of itself is an area to be watching out for. Since anybody's transmitting in the extreme low frequency range where humans are thinking, there ought to be cause for concern.
So I take it the tinfoil hat is not entirely a bad idea.
I was looking at your website to see the extent to which you looked up radiation and frequency damage and its incursion on everybody. So I think you're well aware of the extent of which it can be used.
Well, now by the same token, could I've heard rumors that voices can be injected into people's heads. I take it that that's not that much of a stretch.
No, not much of a stretch at all. Do you want to do this brain implant, real-time DARPA thing, and then we'll do the call brain entrainment? Okay.
Yeah, let's talk about everything, man.
Well, I was reading through this article on what DARPA can do with a brain implant. And, you know, it's all well and good. But you wonder why an organization like DARPA is proclaiming that they're going to work on things that are health, to focus on the health of actual humans. This is verbatim from what they say. Well, since when is DARPA involved in the health of improving the health of actual humans? So that's kind of a front in and of itself. I don't believe that at all. And they also claim that it's in effect they're going to use this this device that they mount to their skull to monitor, analyze, and respond to real-time information on the brain. Well, suppose you're giving a command to a soldier, and you want to make sure that they implement that command. Well, here's the ultimate device to go. Well, their intent is they're going to carry out this command or they're not. And now you've got a wire probed right to their head so you can determine that real time. Well, what do you do if they say they're not going to follow the order? Well,
terminate their command.
Well, that's the part about it that gets scary. And you go down a few lines later, and they're talking about a deep brain stimulator technology, where it's not just a monitor, where there's telemetry going on, sensing, you know, brain waves, maybe temperature, blood flow, things like that. They're actually sending signals to various organs to get them to do things. So now you've basically got a lab rat wired up. You're monitoring what they're thinking, and then predicating what to do in case they don't do what they're supposed to. This is pretty frightening. I wouldn't want that on me as a soldier.
You know, this is absolutely perverse, in my opinion. I mean, it's one thing to, you know, examine things and just see what's possible. It's another thing when you implement them. But I suppose the darker side of human nature, especially if you get a bunch of them together, just sort of compels them to say, well, let's see what we can mess with next. Is that where we are philosophically? Is if we can do it, then, yeah, let's do it. Rather than any moral restriction?
I think there's some of that. I think there's some running it up the flagpole to see how people respond. If they've turned the populace into enough of a sheeple where they won't respond, then they just keep bringing it on. So I think you've seen a lot of that going on right lately. And even worse, is it looks like there's the White House has a new brain initiative program. Well, I just went and looked that up, and they're spending $100 million for the first year of this to essentially bridge what's going on between DARPA and the NIH. So this does not sound good. This sounds like major, major chip implant and control for the soldiers, because they're going to be the ones that volunteer and end up under the UCMJ. So what are they going to do when they tell, well, you know, you got to have this for the telemetry reasons and battlefield, reduce your post-traumatic stress disorder or whatever it is that you think you're getting. And they're not going to have a choice.
How far, I know your crystal ball is probably in the shop too, but maybe it worked better than mine. How far out do you estimate we are from deployment of this technology?
Well, it's already been deployed is the worst part. The brain stimulating technology has been used on Parkinson's patients. Over 100,000 of them in this country have a brain implant that looks to be a really wonderful thing. Okay, it started out as a wonderful thing. It looks like it mitigates the lack of dopamine in the substantia nigra, so that when they get the shakiness from or rigidity from Parkinson's and the shakiness, or they get the other extreme of Huntington's chorea, this electrical stimulation to the brain is actually working. So, but taking that to where we're talking about applying it to soldiers is a whole other matter, what they could do with that, you know, sensing intent versus issuance of command. So, and, you know, and that's a real problem. And you end up in a situation in the military where you're told to do things, and it results in destruction of things and killing people. And a lot of times your consciousness is going to say, well, this is not the right circumstance. I don't want to do this. And so what are you going to do? You can reject the order and risk the punishment that could come with it. In a battlefield situation, it could be quite severe.
Well, I'm thinking that, it's bad enough within the military context, but it sounds to me like you could... You could make the general population just do pretty much whatever you want them to do.
Well, that goes back to this idea of putting a signal into someone's head. Now, how can that be done? Well, it can be done inaudibly, which is the really scary part. it really, you know, in my book I talk about how you can combine a couple of frequencies and have the difference, the sum of the difference gets produced in a waveguide. Well, if one of those, the sum or the difference, lands into your brainwave region, delta, theta, alpha, or beta, 0 to 20 hertz, you could have a problem because when you generate a signal by producing it that way, your ears don't just hear it. It goes deeper than that into your primitive part of your brain that senses triangulation of sound. And through that process, they call it entrainment, you can actually cause the brain to change frequency. You can have to change frequency to whatever you want. But that's all well and good, but there's also brain wave patterns that they found that if you change a little bit of alpha and a little bit of beta and you perturb them back and forth, for instance, you can cause really cognitive dissonance type problems in humans. And this has been documented as the Soviets were transmitting to our diplomats and hitting them these frequencies to see if they do, and back and forth. And there's even something called the Lily wave, if you check and see. It's a signal that supposedly is being put on all the electrical signals through all your homes on the DC backbone. So if you look up the Lily wave, you'll see that there are people with a logic analyzer out there looking at it going, what is this doing here? And why is it, you know, it's perturbing humans. Why are they doing this?
And so, if we were to look up, what did you call it?
It's a Lily wave, L-I-L-L-Y.
Lily wave, good Lord, I've never even heard of it.
Yeah, it's like a little impulse and then a short pause, and then you'll see a spike with two inverted spikes on a frequency domain. It's kind of a insidious thing, and there's been a lot of research into what various electromagnetic signals can do with humans, especially by the government. And this is an area that has been extremely off limits ever to talk about. I'm surprised we've gotten this far on the show.
So am I.
I give you Wilhelm Reich and Raymond Rife, who found a cure for all diseases using frequency. You know, so anytime energy is in the human body come in contact, the government's all over it.
You know, this is disturbing, mostly because, well, you know, there's no point in beating that horse. The whole bloody thing is disturbing, right?
Well, it is, especially when you really start to understand the extent to which a human body is 90%+ water, and you know, if you can put something in the microwave and cause it to heat up, well, you can imagine what those microwave frequencies are doing to the human body.
Augmented by that stuff.
If we felt something heating us up, we'd go, oh, there's something heating me up, I better back off. But it's just below that threshold. The damage can be done. You never know it.
I got to tell you something.
What's that?
I knew this was going to be a good one. This is almost a little bit too good. Well, let's carry on as best we can before somebody out there decides, all right, that's enough from you guys. We get that sound again that's indescribably weird. All right, when we come back, let's just get into everything else. I mean, we'll eventually arrive at the Anunnaki element and everything that goes with it. All right, our guest tonight is Gerald Clark. His book is The Anunnaki of Nibiru. I'll get a pronunciation from him on that in a minute. Mankind's Forgotten Creators, Enslavers, Saviors, and Hidden Architects of the New World Order. Don't look now, but here it comes. This is Coast to Coast AM.
Okay, Morris, we're back now. I wanted to play that because of the amount of information in there that we needed to know about us personally and what's going on in the home with the microwaves and all that stuff. And that was my main reasoning. But now it is time to get down to the meat and potatoes of the situation. For those of you who are doing research on the Anunnaki and the planet Nibiru, and we want to see how that what part it plays in our biblical literature that we can actually go and look up. Some of you may have information containing the Emerald Tablets. That information is inside Talker's Archives, by the way, for those of you who don't have that. But it's very, very important for us to look at everything. I think what a lot of people do is they get stuck, so to speak. This is what I believe. You can't tell me nothing. This is it. And but I don't see things that way. I look at what the book itself said. A wise man will intermingle with all knowledge. So I want to look at this information here, too, and see what they got to say. Who knows? It may not be of any value to you. But as far as I'm concerned, it has an interest in my personal research, and I wanted to share it with you because we have quite a bit of people out there that's not stuck like Chuck. You can actually talk to them about something that doesn't pertain to a religion, a Jesus, a Christianity. I mean, you can actually communicate with them. But so, without further ado, I'm going to go ahead on and get on down in here immediately after this commercial. Hold on.
One of the biggest problems that people inside the United States have when it comes to their mortgage is they don't understand the backdrop of the bankruptcy of the United States and the House Joint Resolution that's already been put in place for the remedy. Now, if you can understand this, the only thing that you will need is to formulate the correct documents and serve them. It's just that simple. Now, there's a series of documents that we have available for you at www.newfreehelpgroup.com. Once you get there, before you do anything, call me. Let's find out where you are so we'll know how to deal with the situation. Contact me, Tahaka Montiel Bay, at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and then we can get you over. Once you get this information on your belt and you read it, you'll find out just how simple it is to get this thing done. What we have is a crisis inside the United States, and it comes because people don't understand what the solutions are and what the remedies are and how to take these remedies and put in place to solve the problems that they have. Go to http www.newfreehelpgroup.com. Click on the link and observe the video. Just examine the whole page and click on the link to Hawker Archives. Go over there. When you get there, contact me at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be in with you tonight for another typical Saturday night bumpy ride through space. And yep, Gold Lion, gonna tell you how it is. Seems like I saw a few gold lions there amongst the other Egyptian artifacts. And what's all this about Akhenaten and Tutankhamun and the elongated skulls? And the Anunnaki and Nibiru, and I want to know how to pronounce that word. One night on the program, we got Nibiru, and I still can't get it out of my mouth. It still comes out sideways. All right. On the Coast to Coast AM website, which you should always pay a visit to, coasttocoastam.com, this is pretty amazing. You know, first there was this dark spot on top of the sun, right? Now there is a video of a canyon of fire. A canyon of fire. And it appears to be, of course, I'm judging from the photograph or depiction. It's a photograph. This canyon of fire is running down through this dark spot. But anyway, now we got Ison headed our way, the old sun grazer, combined with these UFO guys that are running around up there, and they call them sun divers. These craft appear to just go right into the sun and then come bursting out the other side. And these things are big, too. So I'm not up there. I haven't seen one in person. It's a Missouri syndrome. It's like, okay, show me. It's like, well, you can be shown. These things are happening. Don't you find the awakening underway? And one more time, I'll ask the question, how do you like it? We'll be right back with with our guest tonight for the whole show, because we've got lots and lots to talk about. Gerald Clark, his book is The Anunnaki of Nibiru, Mankind's Forgotten Creators and Slavers, Saviors, and Hidden Architects of the New World Order. Oh, yeah. We'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Cheryl Clark, you know, as long as we're talking about, oh, the games DARPA play now, every night and every day now, does HAARP tie into any of this? We had a guy come on the program one night. He was a caller, and he said that he was a technician, worked up there. And it's like, no, it's a communication device. It's like, yeah, okay. Thanks, pal. Do we see any way to do we see any way that any of these technological monstrosities might be activated by the HAARP apparatus, or is that just comic book stuff?
Hi, John. Are we on?
Yeah, we are.
Hey, buddy.
It just keeps going, doesn't it?
Yeah, let's talk about HAARP. yep. It's a very interesting platform they put together in Fairbanks, Alaska, and what they've done is basically put a grid pattern of antennas up that can then be focused on a point in the ionosphere. So it's kind of like a focal beam array.
Yep.
There's a couple things they can do with this thing, and they call it the High Amplitude Acousto-Oral Research Program. But it's very curious that the thing is also, and there's a patent on it, by the way, and you can go read the patent on the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. And one of the uses uses it in the extreme low frequency, which is coincident with the human brain wave, which is the scary part of it. And there's a couple of things that you can do with HAARP. With that kind of energy, you can bounce it off the ionosphere and use it as an over-the-horizon backscatter radar. So you could snoop on another country significantly using it as a radar, which is against international law, according to what I've read.
So why worry about it now, right?
Yeah. Well, imagine that you could, depending on the focal point that you put on the ionosphere to get it to bounce, you could essentially adjust how big of a beam or a cone that projects onto the area that you're looking at. It could be, I don't know, the size of a city block all the way up to, you know, a whole country, just depending on how much energy you want to put into it and distribute it across that cone. Are you with me? So yeah. If you've got enough energy in there that could be higher in amplitude than the human brain wave signal in the ELF, you could essentially, in math, control an entire country with putting thoughts in their head, if that's what you wanted to do.
Or you could
turn the power up a little bit higher, like what they've demonstrated with these Raytheon devices that they're flying along with aircraft. They were doing this in Iraq. These devices were essentially a low-level microwave that, remember we talked about you being mostly water. Well, water boils it when it's exposed to 2.4 gigahertz in a microwave, so they're flying with these devices over these cities and turning them up just enough to cause your skin to start getting hot. And everybody would flee the buildings, and then they would separate the bad guys from the good guys once they got them out running like rats. Well, this is what we're doing to people.
This is frightening. This is what we're doing to people?
Yeah, well, yeah, other human beings, yeah. In the name
All right, let me ask you this. What about these chemtrails and these metallic particles? I suppose if you breathed in enough nanoparticulate matter comprised mostly of metals, that would aid in the heating process, yes?
It could. Well, there's a couple of theories about what's going on with the chemtrails. Are they spraying barium sulfite and various metals in there, in the atmosphere?
Yes.
Yes, they are. Now, some people believe that for using HAARP to electrify these ions that have been put in the atmosphere, that they get some other different effect. I'm not quite sure what it is, and I have a theory about this. Imagine HAARP was being used to stimulate a sphere all around the Earth in order to keep intercontinental ballistic missiles from finding their way back in, for instance. And so imagine you were able to make it strong enough where you could cause things to explode when they reentered. Well, apparently with HAARP you can do that. And this is in there's a guy who wrote a book on HAARP, and I have it in reference in the back of my book. And he talks about this in particular, and there's frightening things that can be done with electricity and magnetism and the electromagnetic spectrum as it relates to matter, good or bad.
So, you know, this is really something else. This is really off the charts. I mean, I was really inclined.
It gets worse, actually.
Go ahead. Might as well let it rip, man.
Well, you know, if you really look at a human and how we're designed, we've got a conductor right down our middle. It's full of cerebral spinal fluid that carries electrical signals from our brain out to our extremities.
Yes.
So it gets down the electrical conductor of our spine. It reaches various nodes where the nerve tissue spreads out, where it innervates out into other tissue to control it. Well, the yogic tradition calls them chakras. you're an electrical being. Let's just face it.
Yeah.
And somehow in our design, imagine that our creators were very clever, and they designed us to interact with the electromagnetic spectrum to various effects. Imagine that was the case, and that if you were receiving certain frequencies in the ELF or other parts of your brain that might be sensitive to the electromagnetic spectrum, that they could light you up for good or for bad. So the idea of the human body as an antenna, as a receiver, is quite significant. But when you go to the article we were describing from DARPA and realizing that brainwaves are an electrical signal, well, whatever you sense, it gets turned into an electrical signal in your brain. This can be measured on an EEG. Well, let me tell you, as an electrical engineer, as soon as something is an electrical signal, you're talking about a signal that's permeating the entire universe and can be sensed with the right technology from any location, including from a satellite with the right amplification. So let me posit something for you. Imagine you're not just an antenna, that you're a transmitter too. Because like I just described to you, if I was close enough with a receiver that could measure your brainwave, you know, they can put a little sensor on your skin and measure it, but imagine you have technology where you can sense it from a long range away. Now, all of a sudden, I could potentially not only use the telemetry to read your brainwaves, but I could probably decode the thoughts that you're modulating on there, too, so I know what you're thinking. Now, with that, another technology amplifier to that, and now let's put it up on a satellite. So now we can look at everybody and potentially read their thoughts just based on their genetic code, if we can affiliate where they're located with the signals and where they're coming from, just like any transmitter. Really helps a lot if you have a cell phone with a 911 chip in it so that they can determine where you are. So once you correlate those two, we're all transmitters. We're modems.
Mm-hmm. We're little wireless modems.
You tell me we're not being monitored. Now, here's the even funnier part. I didn't think we were going to get to this early, but I'll lay it out there for you. So in my book, I talked about the chakras, your electrical conduits, starting at the bottom with your ganglion of Impar chakra, or nerve complex on the bottom of your tailbone, all the way up to the one at the top. And in structural integration, we refer to it as the sphenopalatine ganglia. It's back behind your nasal concha, inside your nose. So that's the more positive pole of your energy body. Now imagine that this is really true, and I know it is because I've been using technology to images for years, that you could actually see where somebody's energy state is, not just their brain waves, what they're thinking, but you know, how are their chakras doing? You know, how are they animating the energy that animates all matter? Are they waking up? Are they still in their root chakra, hanging out in bars? You know, where are they at in their evolution of consciousness? And imagine you could see this from space with a satellite. As little color dots, each one of us, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. It just so happens that the wavelength of the chakras are correlated with the colors of the rainbow. Is that a surprise?
Not at this point.
I was shocked by that because I had a what's called a resonant field imaging meter that I used to go and measure the chakras with this little handheld meter with a high-gain antenna on it. And if you know that the speed of light equals a wavelength times the frequency, you can go anywhere along the electromagnetic spectrum and pick a wavelength, use that little scalar, the speed of light, and you get the frequency, or vice versa. Well, wavelength is color, so you measure it, convert it to the color, you measure the frequency, convert it to a wavelength, which is color. And all of a sudden, you see in these plot-outs, printouts on a computer, that the chakras truly are the colors that the yogic tradition said they were. At various stages. And so I find that very, very interesting. So the extent to which we're being affected by the electromagnetic spectrum, now all of a sudden realizing that how much of an electrical being we are, this is really the hidden anathema to major, major problems for people that are dabbling in this area. So.
Well, this is extraordinary. I mean, I'm a little apprehensive. We may be causing widespread incontinence at this point.
A lot of people that read my book describe it as like being kicked in the head. And I don't know, I like that analogy. So, I didn't get to talk about some of the significant influences that shaped my research that led me to the Anunnaki. We're touching on a lot of the electrical things that which I did actually discuss in the book, and I'd love to talk about them lots more, and including the Starfire Gold that the Anunnaki were using.
Well, let's do that, because I think you're reading my mind. Do you have me on a scope there? Because I was going to
okay. Well, actually,
pull us in.
Actually, one of the really sought-after areas that I did, apparently discussed and didn't write enough about in my book was how these chakras relate to the caduceus that was carried by Thoth Hermes. And so he and his Emerald Tablets goes into infinite detail talking about energy and matter relative to humans. It's one of the most interesting reads I've ever saw. And it's one of those things where you read it once and you realize you need to read that 100 times to really understand.
And what is this work?
That's the Emerald Tablets of Thoth. It's a really, really profound read. And then, you know, so the idea that that we are designed as electrical beings is really amazing. And it turns out Thoth himself, and I don't want to get too far with name Sue, but he was involved in our creation account, and I think we're going to touch on that a little bit here as well. So Thoth, his another name for him was Ningxida, and he was Enki's second son. So,
and who are these? And who are these people?
Well, let's back up then. So the Anunnaki, who are they? According to what we know, and this is mostly from Sumerian tablets that are written in cuneiform. And they come from a planet called Nibiru or Nibiru. And there's two different ways to pronounce it for you. But so the Sumerians in these tablets that we found in all along Mesopotamia, especially in Nineveh and Sippar and elsewhere, describe these beings that they said not only created them but gave them all the technology that they had in the culture of Sumer. So in that account, they describe having come here 450,000 years ago. They were having problems with their atmosphere, apparently, and when they would come close to the sun from their far orbit to perihelion, their atmosphere is getting clobbered by radiation from our sun. And it's funny, you were just talking about some crazy canyon of fire on the sun. I'm going to have to go look that up.
No, it's ridiculous. It's 200,000 miles long.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and actually, we may end up talking about ice on a little bit too later. But according to them, they came here. They were looking for monoatomic and gold in mass to ionize and put in their atmosphere, which is a wonderful radiation shield. So that's what their story was. So about 5,000 years later, 445,000 years ago, Anu, who was their king, and I put a genealogy table for him in the prehistory of Nibiru in my book. And I also posted an entire genealogy table for the Anunnaki on my Facebook page, Gerald-Clark. So anybody wants to go and get it, I put it in the back of the book. Said, people, if you want this and you're a serious seeker, I'll send it to you. And it turned out there were so many people doing it, I just posted it. So everybody that's listening, it's up on my Facebook page. So my entire genealogy table is up there. Anyway, so Anu was their king. He sent his son, Enki, to Earth to get gold. He was the premier scientist, and he was his firstborn son. Anu was married to Antu. That was his wife. So Enki's the firstborn son. His planet was Neptune, and another name for him in the Enuma Elish or the Epic of Creation was Ea Enki or Nutamud. So he had several names, and they all did. They had an AKA list. Each one of them did. So keeping that in mind helps you track them cross-culturally because they lived a long time. So he comes here. Lands in the Persian Gulf, sets up the city of Eridu with about 50 Igigi workers that came with him. That's what they called them. They started to get gold from the ocean. They weren't getting it fast enough, according to the account. They were then using spectroscopy, probably, and telemetry. They found more significant amounts of gold in South Africa, which they moved their operations there, and this is what was said in the documents. Began mining ore for many shars. A shar was 3,600 years. And then if you read the Atrahasis account, which I put into my book, this was by Oxford University Press, where they did the tablet translation. They were there for many shars. And after a very long time, they revolted. At that point, Enki and his half-sister, whose name was Ninhartsog, she was the medical officer. Her headquarters was in the city of Shurupak, where Noah was the king of Shurupak, if you read the Bible. Okay. So it's no coincidence that city comes up. Anyway, so they were tasked to take the Neanderthals that Enki had found on the plains of Africa, jumpstart them to a place where they could be used as a primitive worker to replace the revolting miners in South Africa, which they did, and they didn't get it right the first time, and there were many iterations they described in the documents to produce us, which they did. The first lot of us they produced could not procreate. They were studying us to make sure that we were the right fit and function for this mining task. And by the way, the entire Anunnaki Council was composed of 12 people. Enki was on the council. His rank was 40. Anu was on the council. His rank was 60. And Antu was on the council as well, so it was 6 women and 6 men. So Anu, 60, and there was a sexagesimal number system. That's why they chose the ranks they did. That's base 60. 55 was Antu, and then the next one down, and this is as of 3760 BCE, this council composition. And the next one down was Enlil. His rank was 50. And his wife was Ninlil, and her rank was 45. The next one down was Enki, and his rank was 40. And I put this entire table in the back, table 9 in my book.
And without losing your train of thought there, what is the reasoning behind these numbers, this number system?
Yeah, well, actually, it was interesting. They chose a sexagesimal system, I think, it's because based on whatever reason on their planet, and it has to do, I think, with their orbit around the sun, because it was all by tens and 10 times 6, and then that was the minimum number, and then it would go up from there. And it ended up that 3600 was the period of the orbit of their planet around the sun, according to their records. So I think that's probably the basis of where the sexagesimal number system came from.
Okay.
Yeah. So they're here. They did the genetic experiments. They produced a non-breeding worker to meet the labor requirements. They weren't meeting the labor requirements fast enough, and at that point, this is where the important character of Thoth Ningxia comes in. He was Enki's scientific son that carried the caduceus, modified the DNA so that they could procreate. They were taken from Africa, the house of Shimti, where they were in South Africa, near the gold mines, back up to the Eden in Mesopotamia, in the city of Eridu, the very first city on this planet. In that garden, they were being watched by Enki and Enlil, these two high-level Anunnaki council members. One of them was their creator. The other one was he was a commander, I guess. Let's talk about Enlil just real quick.
I'll tell you what. We're so close to our break. Let's just do a quick recap when we come back and bring us right back into the two overlords, as it were. Okay? Let's do that, because I don't want to have to stop you mid-thought. All right, we'll be right back with our guest tonight, Gerald Clark. Well, I don't know about you, but my brain is spinning. And after this much time on planet Earth, that's actually saying something. Lots of questions, perhaps some calls later on. We're just going to let Gerald Clark just roll with it and see if the next time we have a photograph taken of ourselves by someone, our heads are abnormally large. This is Coast to Coast AM. Yes, indeed, a little spirit for you. I wondered what song what program that song would be appropriate for, and there you go, from the 12 Dreams of Dr. Sardonicus. From back in the days when dinosaurs roamed the earth. Not really. Feels like it, though. All right, we'll be right back with Gerald Clark in just a moment. Please check out his book as soon as you can. It is kind of a long title, The Anunnaki of Nibiru, Mankind's Forgotten Creators, Enslavers, Saviors, and Hidden Architects of the New World Order. We'll get to all of that, but we're in the history lesson part right now, so get another proper cup of tea and get it ready to go, because we'll be right back with Mr. Clark in just a moment on the Saturday night edition of Coast to Coast AM. Hang on. All right, Mr. Clark. Now take us back just a little bit. We have the slaves which could not procreate, and
yes,
so
sir.
We and then take us back to the 12 and the just
okay.
Bring us back where we were. I'm just an audience member tonight. I'm just listening to you. You know what I mean? So just roll with it.
No worries. So we were in Eridu, and we had a couple of high level council members there to do some watching to see if these two primitive workers they brought out of Africa could procreate. So that was Enki and Enlil. So now go back to Genesis and read this part again about the Garden of Eden, knowing the Sumerian account. It makes it quite interesting, okay? And who
yes,
got smeared and what happened. And I want to really illuminate this. George liked the story, so I'm going to tell it good for you, right? So Enlil and Enki are in the garden. Ningxia, Enki's second-born son, who was Thoth, Hermes, and multiple other incarnations, the carrier of the Caduceus, which I want to link into the Starfire Gold, okay? They're there monitoring these two beings that they've created to see if they could produce a baby. Well, in that account, it's interesting. Enki had a very sophisticated medicinal garden there at the Garden of Eridu, according to the accounts. And in that garden were probably plants that his half-brother didn't want them to have. Now, you have to understand that at this point in time, they're both okay with the idea of producing, jump-starting these Neanderthals into primitive workers. Enlil's on board. He approved it on the council. He was the highest-ranking member on the council on Earth, because Anu, the next highest-ranking male, was back on Nibiru. They drew lots and they split up. So Enlil really ended up with all of Mesopotamia, and Enki ended up with all of Africa. So that kind of lands those two beings in those two different places to kind of keep track of this name soup. Does that help?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so now we're back in the garden. They're watching for babies to be born. And at this point, this is the famous account where they were tempted with some plant in the garden of knowledge of good and evil. Well, if you go back and read the account again, and I'll tell you who it was. The one who was monotheistized as God was Enlil, okay, in the Old Testament. So he comes along and says, if you eat any plant, you'll surely die, right? Well, they ate the plant, and they didn't die. They actually woke up and became sentient beings, just like Enki, the evil snake, told them they would. So Enlil lied to him, told him, you eat this plant, you're going to die. And Enki told him, no, you won't die. You'll become aware and start differentiating between good and evil like we do. So Enki told the truth. It was demonized as a snake. Well, Enlil, who was monotheistized by the Hebrews while they were held captive in Babylon and saw the Sumerian documents for the first time, created the Torah account and basically cut him out of it. So Enki and Ninhartzog, his half-sister, were the true creators of mankind in the Atrahasis account. Okay, and I put the original of that account in my book. So,
that's amazing stuff, man. Keep going, please.
Yeah, it's pretty hardcore. Okay, so Ningishida, who was Thoth, Enki's son, was truly a scientist, just like his father. He was premier. I mean, these beings from Nibiru, apparently their IQs were quite high. We're talking 1200 range.
Is that all?
Yeah, does that all? Exactly. So we pale in comparison. Anyway, so they specifically created us to meet a primitive worker function. They didn't give us all their capabilities. So the reality is we're a chimera ourselves. We're a mixture of the creator of all DNA, however it evolved into Neanderthal man. Maybe genetic interventions by alien species many times prior to that. Who knows? Okay, but from that point that we have in the Sumerians, they modified the Neanderthal, put their mark on it, so we're partly Neanderthal and partly Anunnaki, all of us are. So, and that's evidenced probably by the fact that the majority of our DNA, they call it junk DNA according to science, 95% right. of it's inactivated. Well, listen, nature doesn't do that. Nature doesn't produce junk in DNA in any other species, so that's ridiculous. And I'm sure quite certain that... since we've been focused on the Mesopotamian region since the turn of the century, at least back since the 1890s with Major Henry Rollins and Henry Laird, I'm quite sure they've probably pulled out one of these graves and done a DNA analysis to see, well, this is what the DNA of the pure Niburians were, and this is what ours is like when it gets mixed with a primitive worker. So we probably have known that for, I don't know, 70 years, 60, 70 years, if I had to guess. So the idea that these creators are gone and not influencing our lives and all the misinformation is a bunch of nonsense. They've been here since the very beginning. They've never left, some of them, and they've been the power structure behind every government and every one who wielded power since the inception of time relative to man.
Well, certainly a very strong case can be made for this, and you're saying they're still in control, always have been.
Well, let's talk about their lifespans, okay? If you go back to the Sumerian kings list, which Berossus was a historian in Babylon, and he wrote this history of the Sumerians for the Greeks in around 330 B.C., about the same time the Hebrews were being held captive there, coincidentally. Anyway, in that account, he laid out who the first king was on this planet, all the way up to the ninth one on this planet, That occupied 241,000 years, and the very first one he named was Elulim, who landed in the city of Eridu, the very city that Enki said he built when he landed here. So there's some corroborating evidence for you right there. So how did the very first one rule, according to the Sumerian records that Berossus wrote, and this is in the Library of Congress where I first saw this and got it firsthand myself because I just didn't believe it. He said he ruled for 28,800 years by himself. Now, how is that possible? And that pales in, the ages of Melchizedek and Lamech and so on and forth, they pale in comparison to what we're talking about in the Sumerian kings list. Many, many of them ruled for 28,000 years or more, and they were all in increments of shars, which was a 3,600-year period that their planet orbited the sun. So that in and of itself is amazing. And their ninth ruler that ended at 241,000 years on this earth, that account ended at what they called the Great Deluge. So now all of a sudden you've got an account in the Sumerian record that correlates with, you know, this flood of Noah, who, by the way, was a son of Enki, according to their records. His name was Atrahasis Zeasudra, or to us he was known as Noah. So that's really quite interesting. And I'll jump to that in a second, but I kind of want to go back to this Caduceus energy body connection with Ningxida and Starfire Gold, because they were somehow facing a real problem on this planet. And there was an account where the medical officer, Ninhartzog, was visited by an emissary from Nibiru who landed here, and they shuttled back and forth, supplies going back and forth, and so on and so forth. And he recognized her, and he goes, you know, we were in school together, you and I. And she looked at him, and he looked, 40 years younger than her, and he goes, you have noticeably aged. And she started getting a clue that the quick orbital cycles on this planet, how long they'd been here mining gold, was affecting their aging. And they didn't, and they took a proactive stance on this. They didn't do it passively. So she was seminal in coming up with solutions to whatever this radiation close to the sun, whatever it was that was causing them to age. And they found a solution for it, a couple of them. One of them goes way back to the Rosicrucians, where they were drinking the flow of the Babylonian birth goddesses, and some hormone in there was affecting their pineal gland, and that's where it started. So the red flower and all this stuff with the chalice and the Heros Gatnos ceremony had to do with taking in various substances to try to affect consciousness and prolong life. And speaking of that, it looked like the Anunnaki were doing both. So then this is where the gold connection kind of comes in. So, and hopefully I'm not jumping around too much.
No, it's all right. You're a little tough to track with, but I'm trying here.
Okay, so keep in mind the human electrical body that we started out talking with.
Yeah.
Okay? And the chakras and the idea of this symbol that Enki's son was carrying, and I'm going to connect that into the Starfire Gold for you. So that symbol, let's talk about it just real quick so we can relate that to the energy body. We've got a central pole. We've got two snakes entwined around it, leading upwards. Their tails are at the bottom. Their heads are facing each other toward the top. There's a little knob on top of the central pole, and then there are wings that come out both sides. That was the symbol. And you see this in chiropractor offices and medical offices here in the United States and in Britain
today. Oh, yeah.
Well, that's called the Caduceus, and that goes all the way back to this creation account with Ningxida, because he was a geneticist, and the entwined serpents represented the double helix of DNA. So people that were scientists and dealt with DNA, they had that symbol. That was his. So anyway, so what does it mean? Basically, in our construction as electrical bodies, as modems, really, our interface, the electromagnetic spectrum, is specified by the symbolism of the Caduceus. So at the very bottom of that pole, at the bottom of our tailbone, is what's called the ganglion of Impar. And that's the most negative pole of our energy body when you image it, whatever method you want to use. And there's lots of them out there. You can research them. So at that place, it shows two snake tails coming together and then emanating upwards. Well, this is representative in the yogic tradition of the release of what's called kundalini energy. So somehow they're referring to some latent energy that could be stored in a human sacrum, which is really a bizarre shape if you look at it in and of itself.
Oh, yeah.
And then the entwined serpents growing up, if you count the number of places where the serpents cross, it turns out there's seven nodes. Okay, that's representative of the seven chakras of your human body. So the DNA emanating from as an entwined serpent going up the central pole represents the energy flowing up this pole through your chakras once it's released, and we can talk about how it's supposedly released. But this process of this energy fully occupying the quantized seven chakras of a human is the process of waking up to the highest place of energy. And this is an equation that I developed in my book. I came up with an equation to show you what that number is so you can measure it. Okay, so you want to know what your energy is? Well, we can measure it now. And you can determine the extent to which it's optimized for you just using simple math. Okay, so that being said, somehow the Anunnaki were focused on what's called the pineal gland. This is a single unary gland at the top of your head, which Rene Descartes believed was the source of your thoughts and your intelligence. So everything else is bicameral in your brain. This is kind of unique, and he was looking for a place like this. Anyway, in the yogic tradition, it's affiliated with the seventh chakra, okay, the crown chakra.
Yeah.
Well, what does that mean? Well, in the energy body system that we're talking about, and you can image this with our system, is that people that attempt to relate themselves to the gravity field, like people that do yoga and such like that, their body limbers up and blockages are removed such that their energy is higher than people that don't. And this can be measured.
Okay, so this is a real thing. This is not woo-woo.
This is not woo-woo. And as a matter of fact, I've got a really neat system. I spent over $6,000 on it from a guy named Dr. Harry Oldfield, who pioneered what's called polychromatic interference photography. And in a nutshell, it captures a chroma deviation as photons interact with the weak bioelectric field of a human, which you can measure with a frequency meter. It saves you from going in and making measurements all up and down the spine and converting that into wavelengths so you can see it. And it does it in video so you can see it real time. Anyway, so I've been using that system for over 12 years, and I'm one of the few licensed investigators in the United States that use that technology. And I was doing it with clients as experiments, so I need to publish that data too pretty soon. But I learned some pretty profound things about human energy and structure and the way that people comport their lives and their activities. So people that are doing yoga and stretching and watching what they're eating and things, it really has an impact on their energy, and you can see this.
Okay.
Okay.
Listen,
so,
you just keep going. This is absolutely fascinating. I've got a bunch of questions, but I'm just going to keep them to myself for a while.
Okay, so imagine this energy is flowing up like this Caduceus says it does around these intertwined serpents. Changing the DNA is what that's indicative of, okay,
mm-hmm.
Which it does somehow, some way. And this is really a deep topic that Enki seemed to design into us as a way for us to wake up our consciousness. He didn't want us to just be slaves, and this gets really interesting, okay. So, as this energy is traveling up, it really reaches the top of the pineal gland, which Rene Descartes was really focused on. And at that point, something happens where energy releases the pineal gland to actually wake up and start pumping cerebral spinal fluid into the lateral ventricles. That's what the wings coming out the side represent. So when that starts happening to your brain, it starts operating left and right together, and you become much more capable mentally, I guess you could say, and it is part of reaching higher consciousness. And the people that do yoga for 20 years, that's what they're after, is getting that seventh chakra to work so that they're getting the wings of Hermes, essentially.
Okay.
So, yeah, you with me? So
yeah,
that's
totally.
That's pretty interesting ancient knowledge about energy and matter that isn't talked about at all when you go to the chiropractor, anybody that has that symbol today.
Well, I was about to ask you, what would the effect be on civilization if this stuff was taught generally?
Well, it was taught generally along the Nile in Egypt, along the 12 mystery schools that Thoth set up to do in the first place. So the whole thread of what happened in the Garden of Eden about the suppression of consciousness is still going on today. Enlil didn't want humans to have higher consciousness. He wanted them to be primitive workers, period. And if you go back to the Atrahasis account, he brought multiple onslaughts of incursions to wipe out humans because he didn't want them challenging his authority if they grew.
And one more time, I don't mean to be a moron here, but
yeah.
Now, and one more time, who is he?
He was the one that had rank 50. He was the commander who controlled all of Mesopotamia.
Gotcha, okay.
So as of 3760 BC, everything that went on in the Levantine, in Samaria, in even in upwards near Persia and Syria, was all under Enlil's command, okay? And listen, he had a reputation that was very severe. He was the god of wrath and vengeance that was talked about. And so people try to placate, well, you know, these people were really evil, that's why he told them all to kill each other with a sword. Well, when you really find out who Enlil was, he was a great destroyer, straight up. I mean, this guy was a genocidal murderer toward the humans. And if it weren't for Enki, there wouldn't be one of us left on this planet, not one. So he brought after 600 years of the primitive worker program in Africa, some of them got brought up to Mesopotamia, where Enlil was. Okay? He decided they were too noisy. He called a council meeting and said, "That's it. I want them eliminated. I want them gone. I can't get any sleep." This is exactly what he said. And I'm thinking to myself, well, how about some earplugs, buddy? They're busting their butts, mining gold for you down the mines day and night, and you're complaining about them making noise and you can't sleep? Wow. Well, what does he do next? He brings Sarupu disease, whatever that was. Asaku disease, whatever that was. Apparently one of them was so severe it didn't allow a woman to have a baby. It tightened her uterus up, so it was just, you know, womb death. It was unbelievably destructive. Cut off the food supply, cut off the water, starved them. So after 6 years of this, they were eating each other. It was disgusting what he did.
I'll tell you what, we have to take a top-of-the-hour break, but when we come back, let's just back, let's rewind about a minute and a half, and then take it from there and go forward and figure out if some of these great dispensations occurred by the Great One, whoever was the creator of the Anunnaki themselves, and just decided the DNA is too corrupted, we just need to go ahead and erase and start over. I mean, if that even applies to this, I'm not really even sure at this point. Interesting, don't you find? We'll be right back with Gerald Clark on Coast to Coast AM. Stand by. A little explosion for the inside of your cranial covering. This evening, our conversation with Gerald Clark. We just remind you of the title of his book, The Anunnaki of Nibiru, Mankind's Forgotten Creators, Enslavers, Saviors, and Hidden Architects of the New World Order. Well, let's do this thing real quick and get right back to it. We're going to take some of your calls later on tonight because I know a lot of you would like to speak with Gerald. And so that's going to happen. And we'll find out some of the interesting tidbits of research he was able to do in places like Egypt, Persia, and Iraq. And we might even get a piece of turkey as we make our way on through Saturday night and into Sunday morning. It's good to be with you, John B. in the left seat. Tonight, we'll be right back. This is Coast to Coast AM. All right, one more time. Let's have the name of this heinous destroyer of the humans who were making too much noise for him while they were busy mining his gold.
Hi, John. Actually, you know, I think it's a good time to do a little bit of an AKA list for the two main players, Enlil and Enki. And this is really interesting because they turn out to be the two main players in the Zoroastrian religion, too. So we'll talk about that. So let's talk about Enlil's AKA names.
How are you spelling his name?
Enlil. That's how he shows up in the Atrahasis account.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay, he was a commander. He was the top ranking guy on Earth, holding the rank of 50. Okay, his other names in Samaria, where he had his headquarters in the city of Ur, which was the headquarters three times where it was destroyed. He was the chief deity in that city. And
all right. I got to ask you, who appointed him? If he was the chief deity in that city, who appointed him?
Actually, his father Anu did, because they drew lots in the Atrahasis to decide who got what region, because these two could not get along. They had disputes over inheritance rights and a whole bunch of other things going on between these two.
Okay.
Enki being the oldest one, Enlil was the younger, but he ended up being the one who was going to be the heir apparent because he was born of Anu and his half-sister, Ki. Okay, so and it was a requirement for their inheritance to be the one born of the father and the half-sister was the rightful ruler. So the younger boy, Enlil, was the rightful ruler. What were his other names? In Samaria, in the city of Ur, where he was from. And he was the deity there. Okay, there's lots of tablets from that area. We know who this. He was there. He was the one in charge. He's the one that told Abram to leave there and go take the land of Canaan. Okay, he was known as Enlil. He was known as Yahweh. He was known as Jehovah, as El Shaddai. All those names were Enlil. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was Enlil, an ancient astronaut from Nibiru who came here to head up Mesopotamia. Period. It's in the record. Okay. The AK list. Oh, by the way, as we went forward in time, his name became Jupiter in Rome, and he was Zeus to the Greeks. Okay?
Okay.
Wow. So Zeus is Yahweh, is Enlil. Okay. And then the AKA list for Enki, and he's another main player. And I don't want to leave the females out because Nin-Hartog was Isis, and we'll do some of her other names too. But these two guys, since they were the ones who had the ability to take over council positions, it was very important. And these were the two highest-ranking ones. Okay, his other name, he was known as Ea in the creation account, the Enuma Elish. He was known as Nudimmud, and he was also known as Poseidon to the Greeks, and Neptune to the Romans.
Okay, yeah.
So Poseidon and Zeus, the two major players in the Greek pantheon, were also to the two major players in the Sumerian council. So what am I telling you? The Anunnaki Council of 12 is the Greek pantheon. They were the same beings, and I gave you a table of that in my book.
Wow.
And they were also known in Egypt. I left Egypt out. So Enlil really, I don't know what his name was in Egypt. I don't know that they had a name for him. Because Enki's domain was Egypt, so he and his kids had different names down there. Well, Enki was known as Ptah, P-T-A-H, and he was the first ruler of Egypt that ruled over 9,000 years, according to Manetho, in the first dynasty of Egypt. That was his domain, and it was exactly as the Sumerians said it was when his father Anu gave him that region.
Now, who appointed Anu?
Well, actually, Anu, originally in their prehistory, and I give you the table in my book on him, he actually was second in command when another person was in charge called Olalu, A-L-A-L-U. And so Anu served Olalu for a very long time, even though, according to their records, Olalu usurped command and got it illegally. And Anu, apparently being the rightful heir, just tolerated his crap until he found an opportunity to take it back. And they had and the way they solved things, amazingly, was like the UFC, a wrestling match. So Anu wrestled Olalu and whooped his butt. And then because of what he did, because of the usurping the command, apparently he pushed somebody out the window to take over this position. Real nice guy. Anyway, before he was getting sentenced by Anu, who ended up asserting himself and taking over, Olalu escaped to Earth in a craft, and he's the one that actually first reported that there was gold here and tried to use that as a way to get back in and good with the council back on Nibiru. And that's when Enki was sent. So I don't want to digress too much, but I want to keep that AKA list clear. Enlil is Jehovah, Zeus, and Yahweh. And Enki was Adonai. When he was in the Levantine, he was called Adonai in the northern Levantine.
Who is, in your opinion, based on your research, who is the prime creator of Anu and his line?
Well, this was actually talked about a little bit by Enki and one of the emissaries. His name was Galzu, who turned out to be the same one who told Nin-Hartog that she was looking old. He was her classmate. So this Galzu told Enki in a note, and this was in the records too, that they had an encounter with, get this, the creator of all. That's what they called him, whoever that was. So they didn't view themselves as the penultimate, and they were probably races of beings that went further up the chain than them. You know, who knows what the full history of mankind is, and all of the creation is. You know, and you listen to Klaus Dana. If you listen to Klaus Dana's evidence, it goes back millions and millions of years. So, wow,
the creator of all.
Yeah,
do we have any insight into what that encounter might have been?
Well, interestingly enough, Enki was really smart, and he you know, he was given this task to create these beings that supposedly were going to be primitive workers, according to Enlil. That's what he allowed. But Enki created them and didn't want to disallow the fact that evolution is a real thing, and that he noticed that the life forms that landed on this planet were very similar to the ones that he had studied on Nibiru. And you think about that, now how could that be? Well, in the Enuma Elish account that they record, their Babylonian epic of creation, if you will, it describes one of the stars of their, or moons or planets that was orbiting their planet that actually struck our planet in their account. So it's kind of like this accidental impact, but it left a lot of debris, and I'm sure there was probably seeds of life transferred too. And so he talked about this and said, well, you know, that's one of the reasons he chose that being, because he knew that their DNA mixed with theirs would be a good match. You know, so anyway, but so this AKA list, I think it comes out to almost like a football game, and I did this on purpose. I call them the Enlilites and the Enkiites in order to talk about Enlil and Enki and their offspring. And that leads back to Zoroaster. I kind of mentioned that. Very important distinguishment of what happened in that religion. And I wanted to summarize it real quickly. Basically, Enlil and Enki were the two deities that were talked about. One was called Ahura Mazda. That was the Persian name for Enki. Okay? And the Persian name for Enlil was Angra-Mainyu. Okay? One was the creator of all light and wisdom. The other one was the great destroyer. And that's how they had summarized these Anunnaki members of the council. Of course, they picked the two highest-ranking ones that were here on this earth, not coincidentally, to describe what their missions were. And this brings up a different topic about creation and destruction. And I want to talk a little bit about that, because that's what these two beings represented. And that's hard for us to grasp, that a father could have two beings that represent such a cosmic force in the universe, but they did. And that's what the Zoroastrians call them as well. Well, if you look at through all the accounts of Enlil as Zeus, even in the Greek mythology, he was very destructive, very destructive. It brings to mind the movie Jason and the Argonauts from the 1960s, where Zeus is playing with people's lives, trying to destroy them. He had the king in the very beginning of the movie go in and kill a temple priestess, and just tempting him to try to maintain power. He was always working with overweening pride and ambition, the thing that brought Caesar down, tempting humans. You know, he's like this peddler of bad influence in the movie, and it seems to be what he was doing way back when too.
Well, so, who is the Satan character in this drama?
Well, okay, well this gets quite interesting. So,
mix that in wherever it goes.
Well, in Zoroastrian religion, it was a precursor to Christianity, since it was around 1000 BCE, okay? So back then, this was the idea of a creator god and a destroyer devil. This is where it got its genesis, its roots in Zoroastrianism, and it very much influenced the follow-on religions, including Christianity. So who was based on this account, then the destroyer would be Satan and the creator would be the god, right? So Enki is the creator and Enlil is the destroyer, and that's exactly what it was portrayed in the Atreides account with what Enlil did. I mean, just severe, very severe nature. Any excuse to bring about wrath and destruction, he would. I mean, just for even irrational reasons. So anyway, so with all that going on about 608 years after primitive workers started, you have these two seminal forces, creation and destruction, whose father is Anu, that somehow has to manage them and has them segregated, you know, in different continents to keep them under control. Well, about the time that all came to a head was when Enlil decided that the Sarupa disease, the Asaku disease, the starvation, and all the things he did to wipe out the primitive workers after 600 years. And by the way, that's coincident when Noah said the flood came in Sharupak, where he was the king. Okay, so now we're the same time frame of when this went down. Well, at the very last point where Enlil was just dead set on destroying the humans, he finally ordered Enki, his brother, to bring out about a flood to wipe the rest of them out. And he got really upset, refused to do it, but it almost seemed like a military hierarchy where when you're given an order by a higher ranking person, you can object in your consciousness, but if you don't do it, there may be severe repercussions. You know what I'm saying?
Oh yeah.
So whether the flood that came and wiped out the Mesopotamian plains was caused by the Anunnaki, or they knew it was coming and didn't tell the humans and extricated themselves, which looks like that could have happened. Either way, the flood account was quite important. And from that, we found out that the Noah in the city of Sharupik was actually Enki's son. So he goes there and tells him, hey, there's a flood coming. I've been ordered to wipe this out. Pack your stuff up. I'm going to put a navigator on the boat with you. He's going to take you over and such and such. We're going to put all the seeds of life on the boat with you. These are, genetic samples, not animals. There's a seed bank. And he saved his butt, pretty much. So, and if it wasn't for Enki, all the times he interceded on mankind's behalf, they truly wouldn't be anybody left.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, so I wanted to get to something a little more positive now that we realize what the severity of these beings we're talking about. I mean, just imagine having kids. One represents creation and one represents destruction. And he's good with that. And these forces happen simultaneously, and that's kind of how the universe works, too. It's a hard thing to grasp, but it looks like that's what it is. That being said, they're poised against each other, even here and now, and have a bit of... as pawns in every one of the wars they've conducted, and it looks like we're about to do another big one, the final one.
Do you really feel that way?
Yeah.
I mean, you just said it, so I guess you do.
Well, I actually wanted to talk about it. It wasn't just something I felt. It was something that goes on in their term limits and how they determine who's going to be the next one in command. So, and they referred to this. I mean, they invented the Zodiac, so they had their namesakes affiliated with different planets and zodiacal houses. So that, what they were telling us was that, in this zodiacal house, I'm in charge on the council. In this one, you're in charge. And that turned out to be an interesting thing. If you look at the council composition, it seemed to be that the Enlilites and Enkiites were ping-ponging back and forth depending on which house of the zodiac we were in. So the last 2,000 years, I will let you guess who you think was running the council. It wasn't an Enkiite, I can assure you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. You with me?
Yeah.
So the Zodiac, which turns out to be, if it's a equivalent house Zodiac where everyone's 30 degrees, if you do that, multiply by 72, 1 degree of slippage every 270 years, you'll see that the zodiacal house is about 72 times 30. It's about 2,100 years. Okay, so about every 2,100 years, assuming that they follow the equivalent house model and not the actual model, how long you spend in a house, there's a different model for that. Then every about 2,100 years, you'd expect the council to change and a different flavor of rule to be rolled out on mankind. Well, that's exactly what's happened. And it's about to change.
That's really true. But you know what? More to the point.
It just changed. So what's happening right now, and I put this in my book, which is hopefully will give people a little bit of hope. The Enlilites got 7 years of cleanup to take all the people that belong to them, and that's the culling that's going on right now. So if you're a follower of Enlil or his kids, of this destructive force, and you've signed up to that, whether you knew it or not, you belong to him, and he's going to have his way with you. And it's not going to be nice. You can see that going on in the world right now.
Well, yes, and
it's abominable. It's terrible. And, part of the reason I'm doing what I'm doing is to let those people know that they don't have to go down this path. So as part of that, in that council composition, one of the very important areas, and I'm probably on some dangerous ground here, but I'm going to go there anyway, is on the Sinai Peninsula. And on that peninsula and all up and down and through that region, one of the religions of the past was the religion of the moon god, which is shown by a crescent moon on many, many flags in that area, if you know what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah.
And this goes from Turkey, it goes down to Syria, it goes into Iraq, and so forth. So the idea of a crescent moon goes all the way back to one of the sons of the members on that council. And he shows up in the Atrahasis account, this very early document where they were mining gold in Africa, as the one who rabble-roused the miners and said, hey, you don't have to do this anymore. Burn your tools and let's revolt. So he's the one that rabble got them to, the whole crowd to revolt against their assigned task as miners. Well, it turns out he's the son of Enlil. surprisingly. He takes these miners to his dad's house when they revolt, Enwolf's house. And so the relationship of this person, Alla, to Enlil was quite seminal, and it turns out his real other name, and he had an AKA list as others did, was Nannar Sin. So the Sinai Peninsula was named after Nannar. Okay, so Nannar was the moon god, and he was the son of Enlil. His other name was Allah.
No kidding.
Yeah, no kidding. So how in the world did these beings live so long? Some people postulate that they were on a planet whose orbit around the sun was 3,600 years, so that defines a year for them. Well,
right.
According to the genetic or the biological comparison back and forth to how they experience their aging on Earth, that seems to be true. The local aging of the biology on the planet seems to be related to the orbital period around its sun. I don't know why, but it seems to be.
All right.
Okay.
Now, what about... Go ahead. Keep going. I got questions building up.
Oh, yeah. Well, you want to ask one now?
El Elyon.
El Elyon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Same one.
Same one as?
As Enlil.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. What makes this particular spot in the entire universe so special? There's a lot of action happening down here in our little galaxy.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting you bring that up. I think it has a lot to do with what was going on Nibiru. I think they were fighting a failing task to keep their atmosphere composed. So I think based on the resources that were here, the amount of experience they had here, setting up shop, mining gold, learning all about the planet, I think they got comfortable with the idea of maybe making this not only a partial outpost, but maybe a more permanent one.
And you know what's interesting is I have heard that the amount of gold, all of the gold that's actually either been mined or they theorize, or the experts, with quotes around it, you know, experts are routinely baffled, which means they're not experts yet, but anyway, they're working on it. They say that there's really enough gold to fill maybe 3 good-sized swimming pools, and that's about it. And I'm wondering, is this element just not available anywhere else in the universe? These guys.
That's a good point. And I haven't read anything to indicate its prevalence elsewhere. And I'm sure people in the space sciences business that are doing spectrographic studies of all the planets and such, they probably have a good database of this, and I can make a note to look.
I got you. All right. Guess what we have to do? We have to take a little break. So let's do. Our guest tonight is Gerald Clark and his fascinating book, The Anunnaki of Nibiru, Mankind's Forgotten Creators, Enslavers, Saviors, and Hidden Architects of the New World Order. Yo, yeah. All right, we'll be back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Yes, you are. Great to be in with you tonight. And this extraordinary conversation with Gerald Clark. That piece of music is by Muse. It's called Uprising. I wonder if it's possible that we are in a spiritual and consciousness uprising. And I wonder if there's a snowball's chance in Hades that it would be successful. A successful uprising. I wonder if this next dispensation can be delayed for a while. Or if it's already written that we will go through it. And that maybe the whole point is, you've raised your consciousness. Excellent. Now you're going to a different level. Start over. We'll find out what Gerald Clark thinks when we come back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Gerald, it's interesting looking into some mythology here that Sin the original name of the god of the moon in Mesopotamian mythology? Is that correct?
His actual real name was Nannar. It depends on which culture you look at. So
right.
I kind of broke it up into Niburian culture, the culture of the Levantine, and then or Samaria, and then to Egypt, and then into Greece, and then to Rome. That's kind of the way they migrated anyway. And I on the previous show, I said they migrated east, and I meant west. But, yeah. Anyway, let's do the names again. So Enki is Poseidon, and Enlil is Zeus. And it's really interesting in the Marvel comics and all the different shows that have come out, you know, with Thor and and Percy the Lightning Thief. You know, these were the Enkiites and the Enlilites, you realize, that were limited by the Zodiacal Council in their term limits. We didn't finish that before. We're in the age of Aquarius, and it's time for council change. So the council is changing, and in part of doing so, there seems to be a cleanup process that happens in between them, and it looks like it's going to take 7 years. That's what they've allocated to do it. So Enlil forces are doing the cleanup, and then the new person on the council at rank 50, highest one on this planet, is Ningxida. This is Enki's son. Okay, so he was also called Thoth, and according to Edward Case, he says there were multiple instances of this being, including Adam, Enoch, Hermes, Melchizedek, and, yes, Jesus, and I put that in my book. So this interesting messenger who was Hermes, whose sign was the Caduceus, also is linked to this Starfire Gold that ties us into the Sinai Peninsula, who was named after Nanarsin that you brought up. So what do we know about the Sinai Peninsula? First of all, they had a spaceport there that they alone had access to.
A spaceport?
They had seven cities that showed up in my book. Pre-diluvial, they set up seven. After the Great Flood, they actually set up several more. But Mesopotamia is quite old. Eridu is at least 450,000 years old. It only resurged 3800 BC when they decided to go unbury some of these places from the mud and reuse them. But it had been around a long time before. But on the Sinai Peninsula, with Mount Sinai in particular, this is a story that the Westerners connect with. It's the story of Moses at the base of Mount Sinai, right? Well, it turns out that on that hill is one of the Anunnaki council members' temples, and that is Hathor. Her other name was Inanna, and she was on the council as well. Okay, so up on this temple, they were doing things with gold that connected us with this the idea of the Caduceus from Ningxida, and I hope I don't go too fast here. On Mount Sinai, what did we find? We found some white talcum-like powder underneath one of the stones in the floor, the very place that Moses went and said he went up on the mountain, had an encounter with, you know, whoever God was to him, which was Enlil, by the way. Yahweh, Jehovah, that was his God.
All right.
So he was on Mount Sinai with his relative and fellow council member, Hathor, where they were doing what? They were smelting gold. Now, why? Well, apparently, because of the discussions between Ninhartzog and the emissary Galzu, they were aging faster than they should have been. They did something about it, and they decided to find out exactly how to augment their electrical bodies on this planet and stop the aging process. Well, they did that, and we know how to do it today. If you can figure out how to create enough telomerase in your body, you can stop the telomeres from aging, and you'll never age. This was a Nobel Peace Prize awarded to three scientists in 2009. Okay, so the Anunnaki had this figured out long ago, and they were doing it with gold. Now, what was this talcum powder white stuff that they found? Well, in Lawrence Gardner's book, Genesis of the Grail Kings, he points out that this stuff was analyzed, and it turns out to be a byproduct of smelting gold. So here's the gold connection, okay? What were they doing with gold that somehow prolonged their life? And this is where the idea of monatomic elements come into play, and that's what the Starfire Gold is. Have you heard of it before? Do you need me to describe what it is before we start going down this path?
I am many things, but I am not a liar that I know of. No, okay. I've never heard of Starfire Gold at all.
Okay. Well, this is where it started. It was in Hathor's temple. They found this talcum. They started looking at it, and they're going, first of all, here's Mount Sinai, the place that supposedly Moses had an encounter with his God, you know, and this burning fire coming off the mountain. Well, the reality was they were smelting gold, so there was a furnace up there where they were taking gold up to various temperatures. The secret element that they were adding was antimony, and through the annealing process, they were producing this powder, which is referred to as the Philosopher's Stone, and they have many other names for it. Well, these Anunnaki had figured out that by using a monoatomic element, and what is that? If you take a transition metal like gold or silver or anything from the platinum group, it turns out that because of how they're bonded, they show up, their atoms are formed in a diatom. So they have let's take gold, for example. You have a diatom of Au plus and Au minus. Okay. Well, through this process of either annealing with high temperatures to melt gold and add something to it and then take it back down in temperatures at various rates, they were producing this white powder that apparently was releasing what's called a monoatomic element. And one of those elements is the positive ion of the diatom that you just split up. So what you can do, and this is kind of a neat thing, and I discovered this on my own, is you can form an ancient solution called aqua regia quite readily at home. And I won't give everybody the solution. Go look it up on the Internet, but it's perfectly legal. And what do they use this stuff for? They use it for leaching gold off of electroplated things and also for getting it out of ore. It goes way back into the mining industry. Okay?
Okay.
So you can put something, imagine they're gold-plated computer chips and you wanted to get the gold off of them real cheaply. Well, for less than $12, you can produce a solution in a plastic bucket, throw these things in there, and within a certain amount of time, the gold will just leach right off there through the acid of this aqua regia solution. Well, if you leave it too long, this is what I discovered, which is really an interesting thing, and this is where the monoatomics come into play. If you leave it too long, the gold will dissolve into solution, in a colloidal solution inside that acid, and you won't see it anymore.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, so this is another way that you can produce a monoatomic element. So inside that solution, if you were to throw in a certain kind of salt, the negative ion from the diatom, tell me if I get too complicated here, will attach to the sodium ion. And next thing you know, you've got this free-floating monoatomic gold or whatever transition element metal that you want in there floating around. Well, what is a monoatomic element? Why is it important? Who cares? Well, if you can produce a monoatomic element, it actually acts at room temperatures as a superconductor. And certain things at room temperatures, other things have to be really cool. But it's an amazing thing. You put some energy into a wire, it doesn't dissipate any of it as heat. It just goes all through, completely retained. Well, that's a neat feature of a superconductor. Now imagine you were to put this colloidal solution of that into your body. And there's something that happens in the acid of your mouth that releases the sodium to the gold-orite bond that releases the monoatomic element into your bloodstream, all over in your body. So imagine you put this monoatomic element that's a superconductor, and it gets released into your body. Well, that's what they were doing. They were making big bread cakes of it on the wall, and the Hathor's Temple, they had pictures of it, little conical bread cakes, and they... Sometimes it's been referred to as mana and other things, but this was a thing only allocated to the very highest levels of the Anunnaki to preserve their lives. Now, how did it work? Somehow, when you put a superconductor into the body, and now think about those chakras we were talking about earlier in the ganglion of Empire all the way up to the spheno-palatine ganglion, and now you go put this superconductor in there, what is that going to do to the spine that's transmitting these electrical signals? It's going to turn it into a superhighway, and think about your brain, which is a big electrical conductor. So the benefits of whatever these monoatomic elements were doing inside the body, not only superconductivity, but seemed to heighten the energy body and shield radiation all at the same time. The other effect was they were focused on the pineal gland, like we talked about earlier, that was representative of the knob on the top of the caduceus in Thoth Hermes symbol, the caduceus. Okay. Well, apparently, if you put enough of this starfire gold into a body, it would raise the energy up to the point where this kundalini energy would get released from the sacrum, and boom, it would go all the way up the pineal gland and release some process where they had the wings of Hermes come out. Well, in addition to that, Dr. Strassman here in San Diego took some patients that he was injecting DMT into to see if these mystical experiences people were having religion were related to DMT. Well, it turns out they are. And your brain will start producing DMT right out of the pineal gland once this energy reaches through the seventh chakra. And this is the blissful state that yogis describe, transcending space-time, whatever it is that they're experiencing. Okay. Well, this is the realization of the caduceus. That's what it was about. And that's what they were doing up and down the Nile. And the penultimate result of that was they would take them into the Giza Pyramid, put them into a chamber, fill them full of starfire gold, and probably the energy and the frequencies that were being resonated in that Giza chamber were probably something designed to work with your chakras and just light you on fire, jettison you into a higher consciousness, which is where they were.
Let me ask you this, though, Gerald. What is the value? I mean, this is kind of a crazy question, but it's like, what is the ultimate value of this consciousness, however high we might raise it? I mean, doesn't it even take a certain kind of person, let's just say. I'm a little worried about calling them human beings now at this stage of the conversation, but what's the ultimate value of raising consciousness beyond, way beyond, particularly, your fellow earthlings? How does it serve us?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't think anybody's ever asked me that before. How could it serve us? Well, first of all, it could serve us by noting that our electrical bodies are made to be synchronized with the energy that we're experiencing. And gravity is one of them, by the way. Nobody talks about gravity. In my book, I point out gravity specifically as a big part of your electrical body. And so what is the big deal? So we attain this. Well, hopefully, at this consciousness level, we realize that the duality of consciousness is a lie, that we're spiritual beings having a human experience in a big material simulator, and that we learn our lessons. So the idea of applying our reflective consciousness to our state and our evolution, hopefully that would be amplified by a higher state of consciousness. And all accounts are, from what we've seen through history, that that is the case.
People, so it really is, in the end, we're really put here to make choices. That is why we exist, on whatever level. Is that what it comes down to? We're just here. You know, I heard an assertion put forth earlier tonight. I won't mention where, but it's like the whole idea of divinity and God, it just didn't really click with this person because, you know, you're presented with an impossible set of rules to comply with, and then you are tempted beyond your capacity to resist it. So it never really clicked with this person, but I'm thinking, well, it clicks with me. It's that if it is known by the creator of all that you are not going to be able to resist this temptation, still you make a decision and still you learn from it. Is that too simplistic?
No,
if it is, I'm okay with it, you know?
Well, I think it went beyond that. They, you know, yeah, they seem to have created us as very sophisticated electromagnetic beings that probably can be enslaved through electromagnetic, you know, they could put an electromagnetic spectrum in through the ELF and give you thoughts. And there's all kinds of things that could be done. But there's one thing that Anki, and I'm going to specifically point him out, yeah, he was our genetic creator. He didn't consider himself God, but he did consider himself a loving, wise being that was looking out for us. He knew he created somebody that would, you know, had limited intelligence and limited life. And really didn't want to see evolution interrupted. And he architected us in such a way that if you do a couple of things and just pay attention to what he tells you to do, you can achieve a higher state of being like they did. And so the idea of George Washington achieving apotheosis, as it's shown on the Capitol building and through those crazy artistic works on the dome,
oh, yeah.
I truly believe through my experience of playing with the idea of the caduceus, which I think should replace the Roman death symbol of a cross across this entire planet. The idea of the symbol of life versus something that represents misery. Come on. Anyway.
That's an easy one.
Stepping on it. But the idea of apotheosis for all of us was Enki's intent. So he was doing things and throwing us a line to these dumbed-down primitive workers that were being trampled on by his brother. Over and over and over again, and finally there was even a more seminal account where the Adam was taken, and this is in the Sumerian accounts as well. He was taken originally to meet Enki's father, which was really an entertaining interchange between the two. And I won't go through all of that interchange, but on the departure, two of the sons of the Enkiites and the Enlilites were there. One of them's name was Dumuzi. He was the son of Enlil. And the other one's name was Ningxida. We talked about him. He was Thoth, Mercury, Hermes, okay?
Yeah.
Well, they were both there that escorted this first being to meet the father, Anu, and to kind of let him know that, you know, here's the design constraints of this being. Enki set a tablet with his son Ningxida to give to his father to tell him what it is he did to modify these Neanderthals on the steppes of Africa. And what constraints he gave them. He told them specifically they were going to get to live 120 years, and I gave them intelligence. And that's it. And so Anu was like, oh, okay. So they don't get to partake of the plant of life. food of life, which means something that was probably prolonging their life indefinitely, which was why I was alluding to the starfire gold, the pineal gland, and telomerase, which we know keeps the telomeres from decaying. Anyway, there is a strong link between those. So anyway, let's go back to Anu sent Ningxia back to Earth, and he specifically told him, you will be mankind's teacher, period. He had multiple incarnations as that role. And I started to tell you that, and I was researching this through the last time when I talked to George about some of the things that one of his favorite characters, Edward Casey, said about Jesus, Ningxia, Thoth, and who also he named him as Hermes and Melchizedek and Amylas and several others, and the Atom as the first instance of this energy he called Jesus. And so, so the idea that all of a sudden this being who interceded on behalf of mankind through the frequency domain had an AKA list, nameless, just like the other ones, ought not to surprise anybody. Enki had an AKA list, Enlil did, and it turns out that Thoth, Ningxia, Jesus did too.
Pretty amazing stuff. It really is. Lots and lots of, it's a buffet of food for thought. All right, and when we come back from, I'll tell you what, this is we're going to enter our final hour. Unbelievable. Let's go back to, let's just for a moment when we get back, talk about this starfire gold in Exodus 32:20, and he took the calf the people had made and burned it in the fire, and then he ground it into powder, scattered it on the water, and made the Israelites drink it. Ugh. Heavy duty, Coast to Coast AM, Saturday night edition. Stand by for more.
Listen up. Starting this Wednesday coming, Tahaga presents the online conference call. The call-in number to dial is 712-432-3100. The access code 865-074. That's 712-432-3100. Access code 865074. Make sure you're there. Lined up 7:45 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. That's Wednesday night.
You know, it occurred to me as this Moody Blues piece was wafting by that these super beings move between the celestial bodies in craft. And I'm wondering, they cannot be as great can be, if they cannot simply travel by thinking. Because the blues just told you, thinking is the best way to travel. So think for a couple of minutes and then think yourself right back and we'll go on through this hour with tonight's guest, Gerald Clark. And just a reminder of his book, you should have it in your library, The Anunnaki of Nibiru, Mankind's Forgotten Creators and Slavers, Saviors, and Hidden Architects of the New World Order. And perhaps Gerald can give us some insights as to what to expect. We covered the scientific aspect of it, at least a little tiny drop of it, and the all manner of perversion that can be visited upon us from the technology arena. I wonder if technology could actually cut the connection between our souls and our Creator. And come to think of it, what is the soul? We'll get into that with Mr. Clark when we come back. This is Coast to Coast AM. All right, we were talking a little bit earlier about supercharging our consciousness with the introduction of, I guess, the very thing that was written about in Exodus 32:20 about burning the golden calf in the fire, grind it into powder, scatter it on the water, and make the Israelites drink it. I mean, what happened then?
Wow. Well, I actually went back and reread that after I read Lawrence Gardner's book and realized that on Mount Sinai, that Hathor's temple, they were smelting gold to ingest as conical cakes to prolong their lives and increase their consciousness and whatever else the side effects were. So it's really interesting now that you know that. And then go back to the Moses story in Exodus 32:20, as you stated, and I quote, "And he took the calf the people had made and burned it in the fire. Then he ground it to a powder, scattered it on the water, and made the Israelites drink it." Sounds to me like he learned something up at Hathor's temple about what starfire gold does to consciousness, and he was tired of his rabble-rousers going on down there, decided to just change their consciousness for him. Looks like that to me. Done it to you, John?
Yes, it sounds like a pretty strong case could be made for it. Now, let me ask you this. Why is it called starfire gold?
Oh, well, there were a bunch of names for this philosopher's stone. They had all kinds of different names for it.
I gotcha.
Why the term star was in there, I've heard it called white powder gold and starfire gold, and there are all different names for it. And there are different ways to make it, too, by the way. And, you know, the one I alluded to was the old smelting method, which I guess depending on the cost of antimony and how much temperature you got to produce to do this, and gold isn't that hard to melt. But I got to look at the temperature melting point for antimony. As an engineer, I probably have that table laying around here somewhere. Anyway, where was I? Antimony. So the other method was to do it alchemically, and I referred to this in this Aqua Regia solution, and this is where David Hudson comes into play. He was the guy that was mentioned who actually wrote a patent in Britain, and I have it sitting here right next to me. I've been studying it diligently, how to make monoatomic elements out of the transition metals, and including the platinum group, and there's six of them in there. So because of the ease of getting the diatom to bust apart, attaching it to a sodium ion, and then getting it to reconstitute readily. They do an alchemical method of making starfire gold now, and it's actually an amazing product, I have to say.
Go ahead. It'll keep.
Well, I have a couple of instances. I met somebody who'd been using it in Hawaii who was pondering the idea of longevity and its effects on longevity that had been touted. And the idea is, if you can produce enough telomerase in the body, figure out what the precursor is, whether it's food or transitional metals that are put into a solution like we're talking about, whatever it is, the precursor to telomerase, if you can produce it in the body, you will not age. In significant quantities such that the telomeres don't shorten. And when the DNA replicates, this is the end of the DNA, when it replicates, if all the material is replicated sufficiently each time without any degradation, you will not age. Okay, this is what the Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to these three scientists in 2009 for finding. Well, the Anunnaki knew this way back when. Even at Exodus 32:20, they knew this. So somehow this solution of either annealed gold as a powder, or if you create it from this alchemical process, and the bottom line is getting to a monoatomic element that has these super properties, right? Well, one of the super properties seems to be affecting the pineal gland, causing it to open up, producing dimethyltryptamine in your brain. It really does that. That's where the bliss part comes in after 20 years of yoga, is that, okay? And it also seems to do something quite mystical that we didn't really talk about, and that is to turn these primitive workers into what they termed, and I don't mean to be using a religious term, but they called it the sons of gods. The idea of apotheosis by changing their energy body just like they were doing in the mystery schools along the Nile. Well, they were being changed genetically as well. Something in their DNA was being turned on through this process that other people didn't have. And this somehow caused them to have much higher IQs and to be experiencing really amazing realities, longer lives and all kinds of things. So the idea of what was going on with the Starfire Gold to prolong their lives, I think we get that now. And I was going to tell you, I met somebody not long ago who's been a writer in this space, who's been using it for what he claims to be over 11 years. And he's in his 80s now, and he is mystified by the effects of it, including gray hair turning back dark and skin tone changing and all kinds of things. So it's pretty profound, according to him. And I would tell you, as a user myself, it's hard to describe the extent to which it subtly affects your energy body state. It's highly effective.
The little gold flakes that sometimes are added to Japanese food, and the Goldwasser that the Germans put out, was this sort of an attempt to get this going on, or was that just sort of a fanciful decoration for the food and drink?
I think there was probably some science behind it, and there's a lot of people that are playing it. And I have to tell you, the science that I stumbled across in this space that I didn't expect. First, there's the Japanese scientist Masaru Emoto, who was doing all kinds of experiments with energy affecting water, whether it's your thoughts or some other thing. You know,
yeah,
you freeze the water
that.
And then look at the particles. You know, so the idea of energy affecting water and water having some sort of capacitive memory for what the energy is being exposed to seems to be real science. So there's a whole group of people I met recently that are in the mining business, including the head of the Western Mining Alliance up in near Lake Tahoe. And one of the byproducts of that whole industry is black sand, which is magnetite, which all of a sudden is in high demand because people want this to surround water with it to create a magnetic field around it, leave it exposed for a while, and they're doing various experiments with changing the state of water before they consume it, including off-gassing it and doing all kinds of other things. And it's really quite interesting what's happening in that space relative to water and these transitional metals. So another thing I was hearing about was these colloidal silvers that have been going on for a while, where you can buy a device that has a little silver strip on it, and it probably runs an electric field through that, causes electric ions of it to come off, and it goes into the water, and they sell this. And people just swear by it. You know? So, and it probably has something to do with the interaction of these monoatomic elements in there that are affecting their energy body relative to the electromagnetic spectrum that's hitting all of us all the time. And the thing that we don't talk about is our relationship to gravity and how that affects your energy body. And I think that is a very, very significant force field that really needs a lot more attention. And in a book written by a guy named McCutcheon, he wrote a book called The Final Theory. And I've been all through academia. I've been all through the physics series. I've read everything by just about all the guys, including Feynman and everything Einstein had as well. And the idea that we understood gravity didn't understand gravity, even to this day, it was a mystery to me. And not long ago up at Caltech, they were doing laser interferometer tests to try to determine what the frequency or wavelength of gravity was by focusing on the black hole in the middle of our galaxy near Sagittarius A. And this was in 2007 or so, and they wrote about it in this book called The Future of Space-Time. It's interesting to me because I know Marshall Clarfield went to Caltech, but so does my oldest boy, Matthew Clark. He's in his third year in engineering there at Caltech. And so he's bumping shoulders with, you know, people like Stephen Hawking and Kip Thorne, who was postulating this idea about what gravity is. And to make a long story short is we've been taught equations about what gravity is and told it's an accelerated force, and basically it's not true. It was a model of what it does to things, but it wasn't a model of what it really is. And in McCutcheon's book, in the very first chapter, he starts describing what gravity is. And when you read what force it truly is and how it affects humans, It's so important for us to pay attention to it, and we don't.
Are we being pulled down or are we being pushed down?
We're being pushed up. So I'll just give you a brief summary of it. I didn't talk about it much in my book. I didn't want to cause a firestorm over gravity, too, after already...
Oh, why not?
Already pulling the carpet out from underneath who Allah was and who Enlil was and all of them. You know, so anyway, well, it was very interesting. So I don't know if I should go there.
Well, it's okay, but I mean, no, please, go there. Are we being pushed down onto the earth or pulled down? I mean, the song goes, the wind beneath my wings.
Oh,
it's not the wind beneath your wings, it's the wind over the top of your wings.
I didn't want your readers to have too much science in one night, but let's do it. Okay, so in the model for gravity, we're told it's an accelerated force, 9.8 meters per second squared or 32 feet per second squared. Okay, and
yes.
If it was truly an accelerated force, you'd drop something at altitude. It would accelerate and keep accelerating until it hit the ground. It doesn't. It reaches a terminal velocity. So our model of gravity is wrong, at least as an accelerated force. Okay? That's number one. So you start digging into what this number is as we model gravity real close to the Earth, and it turns out to be when you correlate it with the fact that we're living in an expanding universe, and we can tell this through spectroscopy and the Perkinsey shift and a whole bunch of other ways, that all matter is expanding. We don't really know why. And it's expanding at the atomic expansion rate, according to McCutcheon.
Is that right?
What does that mean? Suppose everything around you is all matter is expanding. And I'll do a real simple analogy so you can get what that's like. First of all, if you're going up in an elevator, you're being pushed down, but you're actually going up. It creates the sensation of being pulled down, right? But you're actually being pushed up. Okay, so that's number one. There's an action and reaction that you sense. Simultaneously, let's imagine that there is an atomic expansion rate that happens to be real close to what the constant force of gravity is near the Earth.
All right.
Which we know that's true, by the way. We've just been lied to. Anyway, so imagine the Earth is a big beach ball, and you're the little tiny marble sitting on the beach ball. And the big beach ball is expanding, and you're expanding at the same rate, right? That's what we're saying. You with me?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, let's not make the little ball a marble. Let's make it a rubber ball as well, a volleyball. Okay? Little tiny ball. Okay. Well, as the big ball is expanding, the little ball is expanding, what's the little ball going to feel if it's sitting right on top of it?
I'm thinking nothing.
It's going to feel the pressure of this huge surface area expanding. While it's barely doing anything relative to the big one, it's going to get pushed up.
All right, I see what you mean. Go ahead.
Yeah. So it's going to experience being pushed up just like being in the elevator. And that's truly what's happening with gravity. And McCutcheon nailed it right on the head in his book, The Final Theory. I hope everybody in the scientific domain reads that book.
Well, is it just happening now, or has it been happening all along?
It's been happening all along.
Gotcha.
And actually, the universe, goes back into some of the Hindu or the Mahabharata writings about the various long cycles of the Earth, and I know other investigators have talked about that, including the Satya Yuga and the Kali Yuga cycles that map to the great year, which is our precession of the equinox period that's 25,920 years. So, anyway, did we go off topic there?
You know, I'm sure we did, but it's okay. All right, let me ask you this then.
Okay.
You had a we got to get this in.
Okay.
You had a observed. Now, did you have a UFO sighting or did you have an actual encounter?
Well, you're referring to some of my significant influences that shaped my research on the Anunnaki. Well, I was about 14. I was in the front yard of my remote farm lifestyle that we lived in Arkansas on this little 7-acre farm, and I was out in the front yard kicking a ball up into our walnut tree because it must have been fall because all the leaves are gone. You could see the walnuts that were still stuck up in the tree, and I was just trying to knock them down. And walnuts were big business for poor folk, for Arkansas farm folk like us. You can get those things that bring big dollars. So we'd put them in the driveway, let the cars run over them, and get all the husk off of them, and you'd take them down and sell them. And still to this day, everybody in that area, part of the world, they gather walnuts. So anyway, that said, it was real calm. It was about toward the end of the day, and there wasn't any wind. And I was kicking this ball, so my attention was up in the sky, and I looked at just across the road, this dirt road we lived on, and coming across this cattle field, not even 100 feet off the ground, coming right toward me, parallel to our driveway, was this silver-shaped disc, wasn't making any sound, there weren't any lights on it, it wasn't spinning, and it wasn't creating any wind either, it was just floating about 5 to 6 miles an hour max. And it's just going right across over the top of this walnut tree right next to across our garden and over the top of our house. About the time it got adjacent to our house, I ran in the house, stunned at what I was seeing, and got my mom, and we went on the back of the porch and looked up at this thing and just watched it go out over the back of our property and down into the woods and just started terrain following, heading straight south, just real slow, not even a sound. It didn't even know we were there, didn't care. And I was 14 in the middle of Arkansas. We didn't even have a TV, so I wasn't exposed to what these kind of aircraft were. I had dreams of flying when I was on the farm as a boy, but I had no idea what this was. I just flippantly said, I wonder what that was, Mom. Maybe that was some sort of military aircraft they're using down at Fort Chaffee. That was down south of us near Little Rock. So, and that was about the extent of our conversation. And it took many years later till I realized the significance of what I just saw.
The reason that I ask you that is that these powerful entities, these Anunnaki, whomever, they're not capable of transporting themselves by thought alone. They use vehicles of some sort. Is that the understanding as far as ancient record is concerned?
Well, here's what I know about that. And then there's a couple of instances, and it's a very good question. On the front of my book, there's a depiction of Enlil and Enki holding knobs on either side of this gate, and there's a being who's coming through it, through what looks like a portal. And this brings up the idea of what Saddam Hussein was fishing for in the city of Uruk. He knew that the high-level Anunnaki were visiting the Earth through what looked like, I don't know, like a portal. And it was some sort of chamber that only the very highest ranking being Anunnaki were allowed to use, including Anu. So that's why I put that on the front of my book. And this I give credit to William Henry for really bringing this to light, that it wasn't just some insignificant door he was walking through. And it turns out that the Anunnaki were very protective of a couple of places, usually where their mission control headquarters were. Started out at Nippur, moved north after the flood event, and they ended up establishing Jerusalem and Baalbek as landing ports and mission control centers. So that was a pretty significant find. And if you, just for the readers that will really want to check this out, Baalbek, Lebanon's design, if you look at the structure and the architecture of it, is exactly the same as the Temple Mount.
Unbelievable. This is fascinating stuff. It really is. All right. Well, all right, let me reset my brain and we'll come back for some more, okay? Our guest tonight is Gerald Clark, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And that is Gary Newman, the godfather of electronic music. Unbelievable stuff. Amazing how some of the music written so long ago has such a poignancy for our current condition. Well, it's been a quick, good Lord, it's been a quick 3.5 hours, but we have a little bit more to go. And I want to discuss with Gerald Clark the nature of the soul. What is that, according to his research? And are we about to be tricked into thinking that those who are clearly visiting us and have been visiting us over the many, many, many centuries and millennia, are they the real thing, or are they deceivers? The most astounding things in this universe are the unseen and the unknown, but those things which we know exist. So hang on, there's a little bit more to go. This is Coast to Coast AM. Be right back. So, Gerald, based on your all your research, have you come to any, maybe not conclusions, but opinions as to what is the nature of the soul?
Well, I have my opinion like everyone else, and hopefully it's more representative of the area of your, well, the higher parts. And here's what I come up with, okay?
Yeah.
But first of all, we got to do a couple of term definitions. In my exposure to religious terms and physics terms, I would say that spirit and energy are the same thing. Would you agree?
I'm listening.
Okay. Well, let's make that assumption in our little argument.
Yeah, yeah. I'm prepared to roll it.
So the nature of soul, we seem to allude to it as something that has personality, or that's the filter that sees life through, and it's somewhat permanent, and that it could be the energy that's involved in reincarnation if you buy into that.
All right.
Okay. Well, energy is neither created nor destroyed. It only changes state. So there's a good possibility that if something is eternal, it's energy, and it only turns into matter, and then turns back into energy, and turns back into matter, just like the equation E equals MC squared says it does. Okay?
I'm with you.
So going forward from that, I took that equation, thinking about how do you quantify human energy? Is it that, E equals MC squared? Well, it works on rocks and planets and everything else, so if you apply it to us as humans and do a couple of substitutions of equations, you end up with an equation that's a function of weight and gravity and the wavelength and the frequency once you replace the speed of light. And we talked about that one earlier. So the speed
yes.
of light equals wavelength times frequency, and weight equals mass times gravity. And using those simple equations, you can replace and come up with what I did, which is what I call my equation 5A in the book. Okay, so actually it's equation 5. Now, since our chakras are quantized, where this energy, the soul, occupies matter, then it becomes a kind of a discrete summation, which is 1 to 7 of the wavelength and the frequency. Now, this is where it gets really interesting for me. E equals MC squared is kind of a bounded equation, and the maximum amount is based on just the mass, okay, and the speed of light is a constant. But in my equation, once I did these substitutions, all of a sudden, what if you have a being whose only first chakra is working and the other six aren't? Well, this equation takes that into account, and you see that now that one would come out pretty close to E equals MC squared. All of a sudden, if you talk about a being whose seven chakras are now working, using a scientific principle called the superposition, all these waveforms that are operating at each of the chakras could be adding. And if the energies are coincident, meaning the phase of the signal is coincident, in correlation, in phase, then those energies could add, and they add as a squared term. So now all of a sudden this thing is squared twice, and now you're talking about something where E equals MC squared is not the same as E equals weight divided by gravity times the summation of the wavelength and the frequency from I equals 1 to 7 squared. And all of a sudden, you're violating his equation. And I'm not fully comfortable with that, but as far as I'm concerned, that equation represents what I believe to be the quantized energy of a human, the max energy. And I would say that if it's at its max, that is the energy of your soul. So that when you die and you have some energy that doesn't violate the law of conservation of energy, you're neither created, it's neither created nor destroyed. It materializes into matter, or it stays as energy as infinite intelligence, which I think it is.
Well, that would certainly, ghosts have been stories about ghosts for as long as people have been able to tell stories. So that would actually support the reality of a ghost. It's just it's still energy. It's still out there. It's just, as you say, it just changes forms. It's just released. It's neither created nor destroyed. It just exists.
I think we're saying exactly the same thing. And whether that ghost is a good entity or a bad entity, now think about the variability of the personalities of the humans on this planet. Everything from serial killers to, saints. We got the whole spectrum. Well, guess what? The Anunnaki did too. So the idea of alien savers or deceivers or destroyers is something that's and I don't know if we finished with the soul yet, but I was going to jump on to that next one if you're ready.
It's okay, yeah.
Are we ready to leave the nature of the soul? Do you get me?
Sure.
I'm kind of hitting it real hard, scientific quantizing the energy of a being and saying, okay, this is the maximum you could obtain. Well, guess what? We can image this along the chakras and see these wavelengths changing as a function of the being's relationship to gravity in a big way. So the more integrated your body is with, you know, this line that runs vertical, orthogonal to the earth, which turns out to be a pressure force, the more aligned up you are with that, the more this equation works. It looks like gravity is in the denominator of this equation. And I don't have to beat on it over the air because people can't see it. But when I sign custom books for people, this is the equation I put in there and tell them, hey, look at this and think about the frequency that you're on. So I think it's a very important equation, and I don't know that it's been published anywhere before. So I'm talking about it a lot because I think it's important to people. So putting that to rest for the nature of the soul. Let's talk about your, and this is really, really contentious. I know people are writing books about, you know, the Vatican sponsoring alien saviors, and they're the deceivers and all this. Well, think about this change in the Anunnaki Council, which is taking place at the sign of Aquarius, and we're in the first degree of the age of Aquarius right now. So it's change time. So you're seeing that in the world, and definitely the forces of destruction have been released. And I want to talk about who those are just real quick to bring you up to speed on that. And then I'm going to get into this alien savior deceiver business.
Please do.
In the Revelations account, and I think it's Revelations 13. John is writing about who was the head of the essentially turns out to be the fallen angels, the same ones that were the Gigi that mutinied and left and in the Lost Book of Enoch. And I don't want to get too far off on that, but anyway, it turns out that the idea of an alien savior or deceiver is quite interesting, in that if it's true that Enlil was doing what he was doing to humans, and Enki was doing what he was doing, they were forces of light and dark that were going at each other. Okay, so now this council change has taken place. It looks like there's a 7-year of cleanup going on. In the Revelations account, Abaddon or Apollyon was referred to as the leader of the dark spirits. Okay, so you're like, oh, really? That name looks familiar. Well, Apollo was none other than Enlil's son. And his real name in Sumeria was Ninurta. Okay, so it turns out, also in that Revelation Council, it says if you go to Pergamum, guess what happened to Antipas there, one of our disciples at the Church of Pergamum. Well, he was burned to death, and, you know. And where did this happen? At what they said was the seat of Satan, which was Pergamum. And who was there? Zeus was. That's where his temple is. Okay. So the temple of Zeus was equated with the seat of Satan way back in the New Testament under the gospel writers. Okay? So take that for what you believe it to be. But if you go back to Persia, you go, who was the creator and destroyer there? Well, it turns out it was the same ones. Creator was Enki, who was Ahura Mazda, who was Poseidon, and this destroyer was Angra Mayu, who was Enlil, who was Zeus. Okay, so now all of a sudden, let's consider this. Anu goes, okay, council change time. Forces of destruction, you get your culling. When you're done, the forces of creation, you're in charge. That's what's happening. Enlil and his son are the forces of destruction. Okay, that's Enlil and Ninurta, or Zeus and Apollo. So the idea of Apollo rising, and asserting himself at the New World Order, this is a very, very important topic. So now all of a sudden you go, wow, okay, so there's this alien that's going to come here, and he's going to purport himself to be God, right? This is what's said in the Revelations account. Well,
yes.
Who is this? This is Zeus and Apollo. They're coming to destroy. So they're going to deceive as many people as they can into believing that they're the saviors. And it turns out that in Tom Horn's book, Exo Vaticana, he relates these alien saviors to cooperating with the Catholic Church. And so the idea of Zeus showing up as the Pope is what he's saying. And his son showing up as the commander of the forces, just like he was in Sumeria, Ninurta, taking command of the most powerful nation on the planet to bring about this new world order. And that's the United States. So people have been on the lookout for Apollo and Zeus to be asserting themselves.
All right.
And guess what? They are. They certainly are. So,
Gerald, we have almost exactly 8 minutes, and I want to cover a couple of things with you.
Okay.
One of them is, I know this is jumping around a little bit. This is
okay.
They won't let us go 5 hours. That's not going to happen otherwise. Believe me, I'll try and talk you into it. Tell us about structural integration.
Okay. Okay. Well, the curious thing about structural integration, and this is a form of manipulative body work that was invented by Ida Rolf in the 60s, actually earlier in the 50s, but it became popular in the 60s. What does it do? The application of this particular method that she purports is designed to change the connective tissue body of a human.
I went through that Rolf thing before myself, yeah.
Did you? Well, way back when she was doing it, they used to call them, some of them, not all of them, samurai Rolfers, because they were really kind of brutal and using rocks and sticks and, you know, whatever they could do to get Foster to change. And they were learning. They were trying to figure this out. Well, they weren't interested in so much in a client-practitioner relationship that was mutually beneficial. They were trying to get change and figure it out. So this work got the reputation of being a painful massage and blah, 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 and it was really suppressed significantly. What's the potential of it? Within a 5-week period, 2 times a week, through her process of what's called a 10 series in structural integration. This is an international organization, by the way, but the two schools that do it are based in Boulder. One's called the Guild for Structural Integration, the other one's called the Rolf Institute. I just happened to go through the Guild for Structural Integration when I was trained. That said, through this process, within a 5-week period, for most normal people, the result is that the connective tissue can be loosened through this process, and because of that, the body will more easily relate to these lines and planes that need to happen in the body to line up in the gravity field. Why does that matter? Well, because of the equation that I put in my book, you'll see that the extent to which your energy is related to the gravity field is significant. It's probably one of the largest controlling factors. So this woman, Ida Rolf, stumbled upon this. So mixing structural integration with movement repatterning is what they recommend. So this changing and softening of the connective tissue simultaneously with moving through a full range of motion like Tai Chi or yoga causes very, very significant changes to human structure such that old patterns can start coming out. And gravity starts leading the being that seems to be a primitive intelligence that we have on how to line up with the gravity field once we get awoken to it. And listen, I'll tell you, from my experience of doing this work for, going on 10 years now, and people I know, that unless a being gets this kind of work and interrupts all the patterns that have happened to their connective tissue from the time they learn to walk, that their probability of lining up the gravity field is going to be real hard. And the older you are, the more damage you've done, the harder it is. So get this work early, as early as possible.
Well, they'll take photographs week by week, and you will see the difference.
I do all the photographing with a plumb bob, the grid chart, all my clients. I wrote to my own software for seeing before after. And I've been doing this for years. And in addition to seeing clients like that, I was telling you, I was taking resonant field imaging pictures and polychromatic interference photography to look at the structural changes in their body and correlate that with this equation that I'm talking about for human energy. They're directly correlated. If you line your antenna up, I'm just going to say it straight up like an Arkansas boy, with the gravity field, it'll change your energy like you can't even imagine. Permanently. And
so
it won't stop.
Well,
you went through it. I could tell by looking at your picture. You've had your, what we call the superficial fascia, has been interrupted. It's been changed. And you can see that visually for people who have had structure work.
Yeah, I think you're right about this. And I got to tell you, it was not pleasant at times. It was actually pretty rough.
How long ago did you do it?
20 years. And yeah. I remember it like it was yesterday. It was like, wow, imagine your legs spinning. Okay. It does seem to help a little bit, but oh my gosh, that hurts just to just turn it off. And
yeah.
But I'll tell you, the results are undeniable. They really are.
Yeah, well, actually, they've learned how to do it now in the modern way of implementing this, where there's hardly any pain. You ride the client's sensitivity thresholds where they're fully with you and not tightened up or resisting what you're doing. They're fully working with you, and you're not working on them. So a lot of the philosophy has changed about how to change fascia, and it's gotten so evolved that even the Western medicine people are holding annual FOSHA conference just to figure out what these crazy structural integrator Rolfers, Rolfing is a term that they use at the Rolf Institute. Structural integration seems to be the international term that's being used for it, and that's the one that Ida Rolf preferred, just so you know. And there's all this political jousting of it. Who really cares? The fact is, we know how to change connective tissue through pressure, tension, temperature, and frequency. And it has profound results for humans. And you start this process, and they start relating to gravity, and guess what? It just goes on for the rest of their life, because gravity has been the therapist. We're, you know, structural integrators are just the facilitators. It's an amazing, amazing thing. And I've really been focused on bringing that work to special needs children like my kid, because that primitive intelligence even exists in them in order to know how to stack their blocks up into the gravity field so that it's supporting them and not pushing them down. You know, beating them up, giving them kyphotic humps all on their back and all the things that you see that happens to humans, because they just don't know.
Let me give you 1 minute, because we've got two. And how should people prepare for what's to come?
Well, I think, first of all, recognizing that signing up to dogmatic beliefs where there's an us, them, polarization needs to stop. People need to realize that we're all, you know, in this together. And the reality is, we were all created to live a better existence than what we've been put through. And I think if we could just hang on and group together and not destroy ourselves, I think we're about to see a golden age occur. Hopefully before the 7-year quote-unquote tribulation is up. It could happen sooner if we decided to be. Throw the bums out. Right? Don't let
them
forget this.
There was they're trying. You know, there were massive demonstrations up in D.C. on Saturday.
Well, the good news is creation and destruction happen at the same time. So, yes, the dark forces are getting their culling, but the light forces are being unleashed too. And if you really watch, you'll see them both at play. And so from that standpoint, yes, it's going to be ugly, but the end result is I think we're going to end up with a structure in relation to our true creators that are going to teach us how to live the right way, the way they did in Atlantis. And I put a quote in there from Critias and Plato that talked about the character attributes of the people they had on Atlantis. And I think that's truly what we want to aspire to be.
Gerald Clark, it's been an absolute pleasure to sit through a really short 4-hour show, but I'll stay in touch with you. You stay in touch with me, and we'll meet up again on the electromagnetic wave in the near future again, okay? You know, because everything we can think of is possible on some level in this reality. Many things are visited upon us. Some are a little bit rough. Some are quite pleasant. But for me, there are simply too many extras, from a bluebird and a strawberry to the sensation that's all kinds of good.
All right, Moores, we're back. Is the end of the interview, and we have 7 minutes left. Anybody got a question, follow the props on your phone, press 1. I'll open up the line, and you can let me know what you think about what you just heard. I know this was a very, very interesting information. I have studied this type of stuff with the works of Dr. Malachi Z. York, read the Bible from cover to cover 7 times. During my lifetime, and I've found quite a bit of information, cross-reference information in other books as well. So it was quite interesting to listen to what this guy had to say in regards to this information. And, of course, as we move into the future, more and more information will unravel and be revealed to the people. But in order to receive this kind of information and other information of this kind, regardless of what author is coming from that has credibility, you have to have an open mind, and you must do the research. When you do the research, then you can come to your own conclusions. And so I wanted to add that little bit. And if you hold on 1 second, we will be right back. Go ahead and raise your hand.
One of the biggest problems that people inside the United States have when it comes to their mortgage is they don't understand the backdrop of the bankruptcy of the United States and the House Joint Resolution that's already been in place for the remedy. Now, if you can understand this, the only thing that you will need is to formulate the correct documents and serve them. It's just that simple. Now, there's a series of documents that we have available for you at www.newfreehelpgroup.com. Once you get there, before you do anything, call me. Let's find out where you are so we'll know how to deal with the situation. Contact me, Tahaka Montiel Bed, area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and then we can get you over. Once you get this information on your belt and you read it, you'll find out just how simple it is to get this thing done. What we have is a crisis inside the United States, and it comes because people don't understand what the solutions are and what the remedies are and how to take these remedies and put in place to solve the problems that they have. Go to http www.newfreehelpgroup.com. Click on the link and observe the video. Just examine the whole page and click on the link to Hawker Archives. Go over there. When you get there, contact me at area code 904-303-9061 before 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Okay, Moses, we come down to the last 4 minutes of the broadcast. Keep in mind, Wednesday night at 7:45 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, we will be hosting our National Financial Conference by phone, National Financial Conference call. The number to dial is 712-432-3100. The access code number is 865074. That's 865074. Call the number one more time, 712-432-3100. Access code 865074. That's Wednesday night. We're going to do this every Wednesday night at 7:45 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and that gives everybody a chance to dial in, because at exactly and precisely 8 o'clock, we will begin. So make sure that you are on time and in there so you won't be late, because once we begin to roll, we're going to continue to roll. We won't have time. Late. So if you're on the West Coast, make sure you calculate the time. If you are in Texas, make sure you calculate the time. If you're on the East Coast, dial in 7:45 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Tuesday night, we will be back with more information. Okay, make sure y'all tune in to Morris Talk Live 100 right here at Block Talk Radio. And we'll have some more information. We're going to be dealing with your mortgages, dealing with your credit card debts, and dealing with your student loans and all of that stuff, too. That's coming up, too. So make sure you're here and make sure you got paper and pencil for the remedies to this situation. I have been your host, Tahaka Armani L. Bay, and until next time, you all have a good evening. Thank you.